China has identified the cause of the
mysterious new virus.
Coronavirus.
Coronavirus.
There are fears a rapidly spreading virus has reached Australia.
This is a rapidly emerging situation where there is not a cause for alarm.
The first US case has been detected.
There's confirmation the coronavirus has reached Australia.
China is urging its citizens not to travel abroad as it struggles to contain the virus.
We will be standing up Christmas Island as a quarantine area.
Foreign nationals coming from China are now banned from entering the country.
I have today declared that the coronavirus presents a public health emergency in the United States.
More than 3 billion people in almost 70 countries and territories have been asked to stay at home.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home.
We're asking everyone to work at home if possible, postpone unnecessary travel.
Nobody will be safe if not everybody is vaccinated.
Can you imagine that in 10 years when we are sitting here, we have an implant in our brains and I can immediately feel, because you all will have implants.
Just think of sensors planted into our brain.
It doesn't change what you are doing. It changes you if you take a genetic editing.
It's a fusion of the physical, the digital, and the biological world. That's really the essence of the fourth industrial revolution.
People should not be walking around with masks.
Let me just state for the record that masks are not theater. Wearing a mask might make people feel a little bit better.
And masks are protective. And
but it's not providing the perfect protection that people think that it is.
There has not been any indication that putting a mask on and wearing a mask for a considerable period of time has any deleterious effects.
There are unintended consequences. People keep fiddling with the mask and they keep touching their face.
And can you get some schmutz sort of staying inside there?
Of course.
You do not need to wear a mask indoors if, in fact, you've been vaccinated. Good that you're vaccinated, but in a situation where you have people indoors, particularly crowded, you should wear a mask.
Welcome back. Another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to introduce Carl Hamers. He is a regular contributor to the Barnes Review. He has written for the Occidental Observer. And you maintain your own Substack page, correct?
Yes, it's called Taboo Truth.
Taboo Truth, okay. I'll provide the links. And, of course, you've written this book that I read. You were kind enough to send it to me. I think it's published by the Barnes Review, right? Is that right?
Well, it's essentially self-published now through Lightning Source, but I've sent a case of books to the Barnes Review.
Selling it. Okay, I see.
They're like a reseller. They can advertise it as well.
Okay, so this is like getting around the Amazon monster, huh?
Well, the book is on Amazon.
Yeah.
I'd rather we didn't feed the beast and buy from the Barnes Review.
So, of course, the book, COVID Culprits, An Inquest Chronicle. Okay, this book. So I'll let you introduce yourself to our audience here, whatever detail you want to provide, of course, and then we'll get into this book, maybe the research, how you got into all this, by the way, if you want to tell us, since you're new to the show. So whatever you feel comfortable sharing.
Yes, I'll start with that. Well, I first learned about Our Interesting Times back in 2016. When a friend and colleague alerted me to it. And I've been listening to it just about every week ever since. So I was thrilled when I heard you reading from one of my essays at theoccidentalobserver.net, I think that was my first submission there in spring of 2020. It was called Oregon Governor Advised by Bill Gates and Patent Lawyers. And there you were reading from my essay. So three years later.
Did I cite you, I hope?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Okay. Sometimes I forget to do that.
No.
Good. Okay.
Mentioned my name, Carl Hamers. And
okay.
I was living in Oregon at the time, and I was studying vaccines. The Oregon legislature tried to pass a law requiring school children to get the full schedule of vaccine preventable disease treatments, or else they couldn't attend public or private school or daycare. And that ignited the counter-vax movement in Oregon, and I was part of it. And at the time, Facebook allowed anti-vax groups, you know, full operation on Facebook, if you can believe that. And it was riotous. We had Oregonians for Medical Freedom, Our Kids, Our Choice, Vaccine Truth Warriors, and we called ourselves anti-vax. But at the same time, this friend and colleague of mine, I was making a series of three local television shows. Vaccines were one of the issues, and also GMOs in the food supply. And a technician there said to me, I think the Monsantos are Jews. Well, I didn't have any context to evaluate that at the time. I was completely unaware of the Jewish issue. I just puzzled over that. Even if it's true, so what? But eventually this person got a book into my hands called The Controversy of Zion, which
Douglas Reed, right?
Douglas Reed, yes, yeah. Very good. Published in 1976, but completed in 1954. So a long delay. That was the end of his career, of course.
Well, those editors can be picky.
That's right. Oh, I know that. But this man
better not be any misspellings. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
He didn't skimp on using the J word.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was basically a concise history of the Jewish people, including like Old Testament history, right on up to 1954. And this man who got me this book had a whole library of such books, including revisionist history, white identity issues. And he offered to let me keep them at my house because I had bought a house and his books were in storage. So I did that and I began to read them all. No, not nearly all. There were like 200. But in a strange development, just recently here, earlier this month, I inherited his library. I gave them back when I left Oregon for Arizona, but he died recently, and he bequeathed his library to me. So that was the beginning of my my awakening, my education on these issues, and I just felt compelled to write about them.
Yeah, so basically, instead of just ingesting it, sort of sharing it, I guess, the information that you've been given.
I felt like it would be almost harmful for me not to. It was so revelatory.
Mm-hmm.
I was basically a liberal, even drifting towards a progressive under the awful influences at the time. And this completely changed my political trajectory, my historical understanding, even my identity, in a sense.
So you were like run-of-the-mill liberal? You know,
Yes, I'm afraid to say so. I'm not ashamed, you know. I'm just grateful that I was turned away from that path and onto my new path.
Well, that's more, and that's kind of the default position of, like, for since the second half of the 20th century for most Americans, in one degree or another, you know, is take that liberal position, whether you're conservative, liberal, or a Democrat, liberal. Yeah.
I think Warren Ballew from National Justice Party had the same trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
He was liberal and then went basically American National Socialist,
mm-hmm.
which is part of my studies. You know, a lot of what I write at the Barnes Review is on revision of National Socialist history. I have the cover article on this month, actually March and April, on the history of National Socialism in America. But I write a lot about Jews, particularly at the Occidental Observer. a lot of the books in this library on the Jewish issue, not just Douglas Reed. And so, you know, recently you saw the news in Florida that Handsome Truth and the Goyim Defense League was tossing literature onto the driveways.
Yeah.
You remember this? I think you and Joe talked about it. And the literature was a little handout about the Jewish role in COVID. Well, my book is an attempt to chronicle that in much greater detail and really substantiate that, you know, far from just a little list with, you know, Israeli six-pointed stars next to them. Mm-hmm. And that's really the objective, although it's not the only theme of the book. In fact, so I divide the book into basically four sections. It's 15 chapters, 275 pages with 670 footnotes or endnotes. So a kind of a resource density of 2.5 endnotes per page. You know, I aspire to the kind of writing that Whitney Webb does, which is very information dense. Mm-hmm. And, you know, substantiating everything I present. So the first, the first three chapters try to establish the context for the core of the book, which is chapter one, not all Jews. Chapter two, Semitophobia, fear of Jews. And chapter three, Jewish anti-Semitism. You know, it's not a focus on Jews as, you know, perpetrators of the COVID phenomenon, but it establishes this context that we're not talking about all Jews. You know, it's strange we even have to say that, but I start off with a quote from Laurent Guillaumeau's book, From Yahweh to Zion. Any injustice against a Jew is a little Auschwitz. Every Jew killed is a potential genocide. So we have to dispel this myth that if we're criticizing or denouncing Jews for anything, we're implicating all Jews, because that's a kind of protection racket that the Jewish power elite uses, right? If we criticize one Jew, we're implicating all of them, and so you can't do even one. But we have to debunk that, and I go through many Jews who themselves criticize other Jews. The Russian oligarch Berezovsky was confronted by Putin and expelled from the country. And other Jews in Russia blamed the Jewish oligarchs for giving Jews a bad name. So they didn't join in the, you know, the claim that Putin was engaged in anti-Semitism. They agreed that the Jewish oligarchs were, you know, an atrocity in Russia, and the other Jews didn't want anything to do with those Jews. So that was an example of not all Jews. And there's quite a few others. The German Jews of 1933 opposed the international boycott that the international Jews tried to impose on Germany. As you know, Samuel Untermeyer being the architect of that boycott. The German Jews didn't want anything to do with it. They had good prospects in the German revival, and they didn't want Germany's looking badly at them. So those were Jews, those were an example of not all Jews. Many Jews opposed the creation of Israel for different reasons. Hitler's Jewish Soldiers, the book by Brian Mark Riggs, which recounts there were 150,000, at least half Jews, known as Mischlings, in the German Wehrmacht during the Second World War. And, you know, at least some of them were genuinely fighting for love of the fatherland and to defend Germany against the communist threat. So that was an example of not all Jews, and quite a large one. And then I go to individuals such as Benjamin Friedman, who used to be Jewish and converted, I think, to Catholicism. And he spent the rest of his life trying to expose the Jewish power cabal that, you know, was manipulating so many world events and really seeking a dominance over the world, not a conspiracy theory, but, and Benjamin Friedman was one of them to begin with. He was a secretary. He was the liaison between the Secretary of the Treasury under Wilson and the Senate Finance Committee, which was chaired by Henry Morgenthau Sr. He also attended the Treaty of Versailles and was at the Nuremberg trials. So he was powerful insider that perhaps had an attack of conscience and started to expose this Jewish agenda for world control. And he was a Jew himself, so not all Jews. Then Gilad Atzmon is a contemporary Jew who does the same thing as Benjamin Friedman. Paul Eisen, he wrote the book My Life as a Holocaust Denier. Mm-hmm. He's Jewish, you know. Ron Unz, he's the the curator of the online journal The Unz Review, which is hugely popular. He wrote the American Pravda series, which contains an essay called A Holocaust Denial, in which he reviews all the revisionist accounts of the Holocaust and agrees that the standard Holocaust narrative is substantially false and quite possibly almost entirely so. That's Ron Unz's conclusion.
He also gives very sympathetic, objective analysis of the run-up to the war and also the position of the Third Reich in the opening days of the war.
Is that in his American Pravda series?
It is, yeah. It talks about the run-up to the war and all the intrigues, British and American diplomatic intrigues to provoke a war. You know.
Mm-hmm. Astonishing for a Jewish man, but that's an example of not all Jews. So, and it's unclear whether he's a kind of controlled opposition or a kind of relief valve, or whether he's genuine, because the Anti-Defamation League has been very mild in their criticism of him. He writes about that too. He thinks the Anti-Defamation League is afraid of drawing attention to his work.
Yeah, there might be their strategy might be dynamic silence regarding him. So
right,
don't raise attention. Yeah,
that's not clear, because it's also very damaging to the Anti-Defamation League to let Ron Unz continue with this.
He's also very big in provoking in promoting the narrative of COVID being a real dangerous pandemic when they're.
Yes. And in particular, a lab engineered.
Yes.
Bioweapon, which I don't agree with. So, you know, chapter two is called Semitophobia. We establish the fear that organized Jews, what we might call the Jewish power elite, have over many places in the world, including the U.S. Congress. I start off by saying the greatest mass fear in the U.S. is not Islamophobia, homophobia, or even xenophobia. It's Semitophobia, fear of Jews. And then there's many examples, such as William Latson was the black Florida school principal who proposed that other perspectives on the Holocaust should be taught in the school system. Well, you know, Jews promote blacks when they're anti-white, but when, you know, blacks go off the plantation, then Jews really crack down on him. And William Latson was threatened with, you know, every kind of, you know, demonetization. He's going to lose his job. He couldn't get another job. So he caved and capitulated to Semitophobia. And he said, I'm not a Holocaust denier, so... You know,
I think he said it's controversial or something. And they're like, what?
Uh-huh. Can't have that.
It's so controversial. He lost his job over it. It's obviously.
Ilhan Omar didn't lose her seat in the Congress, but she said there's a certain lobby that has a lot of influence over the U.S. Congress, and it's all about the Benjamins baby. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
The money. Well, she didn't have to basically apologize, but she kind of diluted that by saying, well, there's other lobbies that also exercise control. And so.
Yeah, I think that was the when that happened, it was the one time the Republicans feel bold enough to criticize a black woman is when she's criticizing Jews. There's a hierarchy, obviously. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. The other Congress people who have spoken out about Jewish power are Gus Savage, James Traficant, and Cynthia McKinney. She's black from Georgia. Mm-hmm. I think you and Joe were talking about James Traficant recently on Powers and Principalities. He was thrown in jail for 7 years for pointing out the power of the Israel lobby and the U.S. military is fighting wars on behalf of Israel and our kids are coming back in body bags. And then he was eventually, it appears that he was assassinated in a tractor accident on his farm in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And that's perhaps the greatest Semitophobia, is that the really the Jewish organized crime syndicate will assassinate people.
The same with James Forrestal jumped out the window, right?
Yes, indeed. Sure, yeah. He did. Yep, he was not in favor of the creation of the Nation of Israel. He was the Secretary of War at the time, or the first Secretary of Defense. That's another story, the Forrestal Diaries, in which it was reported that international Jews pushed Great Britain into World War II. Steve King, I'm talking about as a subject to Semitophobia. He said something like, what's wrong with Western civilization and white supremacy? So Jews forced him onto a Holocaust tour in Poland. But while he was there, he asked the Poles if the Nazis or the communists were a worse occupier. So, you know.
Didn't he also say something about, why don't we just make our own babies or something?
Oh, I'm not aware of that, did he?
Yeah.
I would like to see Steve King for president.
I think that's what led him to lose his seat, and ultimately, I think he's out of Congress now. So.
Yeah, unfortunately, but not surprising.
Kevin McCarthy set him up or something. It was a whole deal.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Probably among the worst Semitophobia is blackmail by, like, the Epstein strategy. That's over a lot of people's heads. They could be blackmailed, but, you know, they've been caught into the Jewish web of atrocities, you know, raping children. So that's a form of Semitophobia. Also, that the funding that Jews like Sheldon Adelson gave to, in that case, Republican candidates, they're breathless with fear that the money will go to an in-party candidate in the primaries.
Yeah, I believe the top 10 donors to the Democratic Party are Jewish billionaires, and the top 8 to the Republican Party are Jewish billionaires.
Right.
So
if you don't get the money, you're out of luck. It's a fear of lack of funding. So they all line up at AIPAC and grovel and pretty much beg for money. There's a whole lot of examples here. I don't know how much time we want to spend. Patrick Little ran for president as an NSDAP Republican. He had a whole platform against Jewish power. Pastor Charles Baldwin tries to educate people against the influence of the Scofield Bible Supplement that creates Christian Zionists. Ongoing news now, Monica and Alfred Schaefer were imprisoned for Holocaust denial in Germany. Mm-hmm. Even though Monica made a 6-minute video, you know, forgiving her parents for not doing more to stop the Holocaust, because she now knows it never really happened as described. So she visited Germany and was thrown in jail for that. Semitophobia. But she seems kind of immune to fear of Jews. She's maintains a very good attitude and a positive outlook. And let's see, a couple of nations have been subject to fear of Jews. Poland tried to pass a law saying that you couldn't extort Poland for Holocaust reparations because they were occupied by Germany and didn't really participate in the Holocaust. Well, the international Jews like jumped all over them and tried to make them repeal the law, but they held firm and they maintained that. But Iceland did not. Iceland caved to Semitophobia and withdrew its circumcision law. Now, there are only 250 Jews in Iceland, Tim, and there's like only under a 500,000 people in the entire nation. But international Jews like threatened Iceland with a boycott of its tourism industry, which is just about its only income, unless they withdrew this law. Like they said, they would not allow circumcision until the age of 18. When a boy could make his own decision. Well, that was not allowed.
I saw the headline is Judea declares war on Iceland.
Oh, really?
No, I'm joking.
Just like 1933. Well, it pretty much what happened. And Iceland caved to that fear. So I close that chapter with the quote, an anti-Semite is someone who dislikes Jews more than is absolutely necessary. So if we don't at least dislike Jews such as George Soros, Adelson, Epstein, and many others, then we are Jewish child-raping, warmonger sympathizers. Confronting Jewish power is now the honorable and decent thing to do.
You saw that ADL tweet regarding Donald Trump's remarks?
Was that recent?
Yeah. No. Donald Trump came out and gave a speech that we need to expel or exclude warmongers, communists, traitors, anarchists, you know, from our country. And ADL said something to the effect that was anti-Semitic.
I heard about that on your show with Joe Atwood.
Yeah, and they have all these comments. Are you saying that Jews are warmongers, communists? Like, well, you know, it's just like the same way when David Icke talks about lizard people, and you know, and they go, "Hey, what are you talking about us?"
Right. Or even if you criticize corporate executives.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, that's anti-Semitic. Well, they're pretty much admitting something that.
Yeah.
No one's really saying. Yeah, it's like, what is it? The guilty flee where none pursueth.
Yeah.
My third chapter in this, setting the stage really for the rest of the book, is Jewish anti-Semitism, Jew on Jew hate or persecution or even slaughter. And I start with the Old Testament Levite priests. That story of Moses came back from the mountain and the Aaron and the idolaters were worshiping the golden calf. So Moses sicked the Levites on them and slaughtered them for their idolatry. And then the Levites were promoted to the spiritual leadership of the Israelites. And of course, the people they slaughtered were their own kin. Some of them were Levites themselves and other Israelites. So I consider that Jewish anti-Semitism. And the story of Jesus as well, if he was a Hebrew anyway, perhaps an Essene. And the Pharisees, you know, arranged for him to be captured by the Romans and crucified and executed. Certainly a case of Jewish anti-Semitism. You might have something to say about that.
Well, it's the idea that better one man die than a whole nation perish. And Jesus challenged their position, their ethnic pride at the time, because Jesus, you know, pretty much said, you know, seed of Abraham doesn't mean anything. God can turn those stones into people if he wants to. Your seed doesn't supersede God. And I guess it was Jesus's universal, you know, mission is what upset them. They were no longer chosen, you know, and so.
That's been a contention ever since. Mm-hmm. I mean, his betrayer was named Judah.
Yeah. And the whole idea there is, again, the Christian perspective is that, you know, there were the avenue which God chose to bring the Messiah, the Redeemer of all mankind. And of course, once Jesus came, their moment had passed, you know, and this is the whole idea of supersessionism and the new covenant. And I guess their identity as a people and mattered more than you know, then the redemption of mankind. And so and this they're undoing, because then they rebel in about 70 through 130 AD. That's when the temple's destroyed and they're dispersed. And that's when you have the development of Talmudic Judaism, which is very different than Mosaic Judaism, you know.
I discussed that in this book. Yeah. Talmudic Judaism is applied today to vaccine programs and epidemics. But just finishing with Jewish anti-Semitism, Jacob Frank, the kind of extreme Talmudic, he wasn't Talmudic, he was like a satanic cult leader that thought he was the reincarnation of the Jewish Messiah, depraved madman. And he thought if all the Jews could be perverse and degraded and corrupt enough, that would bring the Jewish Messiah to prominence. The story of the SS Patria, a ship with 180 Jewish refugees that was the British were at first bringing into Palestine and then decided to reroute to Mauritius, an island off of Africa, because the Arabs were too upset with all the Jews coming into Palestine. Well, before it could leave, a bomb exploded and almost sank the Patria, and 270 people were killed, including most of them were Jews. Turns out the bomber was Munya Mardor. He was an agent of the Haganah, the Jewish Zionist terrorist group. That's a good example of Jewish anti-Semitism. And a few others that you might want to read this chapter to understand why Kristallnacht was a case of Jewish anti-Semitism. Because the International League Against Anti-Semitism, based in Paris, appears to have arranged, which of course was a Jewish organization, something like the ADL claiming to fight against anti-Semitism, actually organized and perpetrated Kristallnacht. One big reason was the British Parliament was in the process, they had a deadline of November 9th to decide whether to stop Jewish emigration to Palestine. So the Parliament was coming to this decision. So the International League of Anti-Semitism Jews arranged for Kristallnacht to influence the Jewish Parliament to vote in favor of more Jews going to Palestine, because look how dangerous it was for them elsewhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole interesting story. In fact, it's the cover article for this month's Barnes Review, March, April.
Most people are kind of familiar with that tactic, and not most people. I mean, people who are kind of keen to the issue are at least aware of that tactic of,
yes,
you know, carrying out an incident and blaming another party, or at least instigating it or provoking it, and then spinning it or creating a narrative around that incident that's favorable
to you. Right, a false flag.
Yeah.
There's a meme about that, what you do in Rabbi.
Yeah.
Right? They showed a rabbi painting a swastika on the wall of a synagogue.
A mild form of that would be the Jewish student, you know, at American University drawing swastikas around and getting caught for it. And it's like, I'm just trying to raise awareness.
Right.
Yeah. You know, playing the victim. Blacks do that a lot too, obviously.
At least dozens of Jews died in Kristallnacht, and there's a lot of damage. And mm-hmm. So that was not a mild example. In the next section of the book, the next eight chapters, I consider the core of the book, which really focuses on the Jewish role in COVID, the COVID phenomenon. I call it at times a scamdemic, a plandemic, a patterndemic, a panicdemic, anything but a real pandemic. And, you know, provide information why that is so. And primarily, though, how the Jews involve themselves in creating it and profiting from it and extending their power and control. So chapter four is Corona Agenda, Jews of the Council on Foreign Relations. You know, and currently the...
That is interesting, because a lot of people think of the Council for Foreign Relations, they think the Dulles brothers, the WASP establishment, but like so much that has occurred since 1945, is these institutions have been infiltrated or taken over by Jewish power, largely.
Yes, that's right. And like currently, three of the top four positions of leadership at the CFR are Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Haas has been there for 20 years. But among the founders of the CFR in 1921 was Walter Lippmann. He was a Jew, and he's considered the father of modern journalism. You know, elsewhere in the book, I point out that it's thought that the CFR has influenced over 90% of U.S. media.
Yeah, that's how it's coordinated, more or less. That's why... Remember, you know, if you're the editor of the New York Times or the Washington Post or is CNN or something, you're going to go to their confabs, you know, and
right.
meet and coordinate. You'll be a member in your talk. And, you know, it's probably like any other organization. There's degrees of membership where, you know, the higher you go, the more you're kind of aware of what's going on. Sort of a Masonic design, you know, mm-hmm. But they'll include journalists, actresses and actresses and celebrities, because it's all about sort of maintaining narrative control and the media, entertainment. So it's almost like it's full, it's kind of like full dominance, you know, of the whole narrative done through the press.
Absolutely.
And media.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Full spectrum dominance, as the yes. Pentagon would call it.
Right, that is it. I frame this chapter between the October 30th, 1938 broadcast of the War of the Worlds from the Princeton Radio Project,
mm-hmm.
in which 20% of the listeners actually panicked, thinking you know, Martians were attacking. And the COVID narrative, in which many people believed a virus was attacking, mm-hmm. and how the War of the Worlds broadcast was, the Princeton Radio Project was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation mm-hmm. and really organized and administered by the Council on Foreign Relations as a test of, you know, just how well they could panic the public. And, you know, throughout the chapter, I developed the idea that by 2020, they had refined their techniques and, you know, succeeded quite well in inducing panic with a fabricated fictional story.
Yeah, there's a book written about that. Christopher Simpson, I think is the name. He's an American University professor called The Science of Coercion. He doesn't call out the Jewish role in it, but if you read those involved, a lot of Jewish names in it, let's just say that. But he talks about the whole study of mass communication, mass media was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, also by the War Department, and then the Pentagon, and then the Central Intelligence Agencies. And it's all done for the purpose of refining the means of mass manipulation through mass media. And then it spills over into entertainment and news, because a lot of the people who established like CBS News, of course, yes. Jewish, Sarnoff,
William Paley,
and also a lot of the journalists, some of the famous journalists, all came from the intelligence agencies and the psychological war agencies of the war, of Second World War, you know, like Walter Cronkite. Obviously, Edward R. Murrow, he was like an actor at first, but they all came from the Office of War Information and also OSS. And these people fanned out and populated post-war media, you know.
Yes, that's right. Fear being the main, well, I shouldn't say the main, but one of the main strategies that they use the media to induce fear, you know.
Keep watching the skies.
Yeah. H.G. Wells wrote The War of the Worlds, mm-hmm. and he also wrote a book in 1940 published called The New World Order, if you can believe it. And a lot of themes in his books were about microbes and pandemics and disease. And in fact, the Martians in The War of the Worlds did not die from human weapons. The Martians had very advanced technology. They had force fields and laser beams and poison gas. They were defeated by lowly microbes, just basically viruses. That, you see, they had this advanced technology, Tim, but they didn't have effective vaccines. Oh, gosh. Here's what H.G. Wells said in 1940 in the book New World Order. To get rid of Hitler and his Nazis will be no more a cure for the world's ills than scraping will heal measles. The disease will manifest itself in some new eruption. It is the system of nationalist individualism and uncoordinated enterprise that is the world's disease, and it is the whole system that has to go. Well, that's just a good summary of the Great Reset they're promoting today from the World Economic Forum.
Yeah, and blaming nation states, local government, if you will, representative parliaments, and these things are messy. They can't coordinate them. So you need some of an overarching body controlled by, I guess, enlightened scientists. If you will. This is like a technocracy. But of course, one thing we did notice with the whole COVID stuff is all these scientists that were making all these false, ridiculous claims that were eventually exposed. They were all on the payroll of Bill Gates. Who's a college mm-hmm. dropout, so much for technology and experts.
Yes. Yeah, they're front people, they're actors.
Yeah.
You know, I get to chapter 5. There are two chapters called Covert COVID Jews. And I considered making that the title of the book, but I was advised against it. It would never make it on Amazon. And it would be, you know, quickly denounced and mm-hmm. deplatformed. And so I was advised to even myself obscure the Jewish issue in the title and in the text on the back cover. But I get straight into it here, chapter 5, Covert COVID Jews, starting with Charles Lieber, the Harvard nanotech professor and scientist. He was selling nanotech secrets to the Chinese, and he didn't inform the FBI about the money he was getting. He also didn't report it on his taxes. So that was a mainstream news story. He founded Nanosys and Vista Therapeutics, private firms that were, you know, selling or developing biotech, nanotech for use in medical, including vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
He was funded by DARPA, Naval and Air Force Intelligence. And so he was getting lots of funding from the U.S., and then he was getting funding from China. So he went to prison. He had six counts where, you know, what's the word I want? He was accused of six counts. Or I don't know the legal term. Six counts against him were applied, you know.
Mm-hmm.
His attorney was Mark Mukasey. He's the most prominent trial lawyer in the nation, and he's Jewish. And I move on quickly to Mark Sussman became the CEO of Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation on February 1st, 2020. So right in the beginning of the whole COVID phenomenon. And his aunt was a in the Parliament of South Africa, basically a Communist Party member. I think they call themselves progressives. And he's very reverential towards his Aunt Helen. That's how he found out he was Jewish. His aunt was operating in South Africa. They were trying to, like, make prison conditions better for the communists, Nelson Mandela,
mm-hmm.
and the African National Congress.
Well, they're responsible for South Africa being such a paradise now. Yeah.
That's right.
You're welcome.
Yep. That awful apartheid was treating those blacks so badly. They definitely had it much better. But let me just list the names. There's Cass Sunstein. I feature him in this chapter. He was appointed the chairman of the World Health Organization Technical Advisory Group Behavioral Insights and Sciences for Health. In other words, he was like the spin doctor that was trying to like nudge the whole world into getting vaccinated.
Well, he's the guy who came up with that term cognitive infiltration, right?
Right.
Yeah.
He called for infiltration of extremist groups, including like with direct in real life agents, something like COINTELPRO.
Mm-hmm. And his wife, yeah. His wife is Samantha Powers, who's, from what I understand, right now in Hungary stirring up trouble.
She was the ambassador to the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, Samantha Powers. But Cass Sunstein just looks like a vile person. He's like a mass mind control, you know, devil. It's awful. He tried to like rewrite the First Amendment right to free speech. He wrote the book Conspiracy Theories, Causes and Cures. Sorry, that was a paper. He was appointed to the Pentagon's Civilian Innovation Board. The Pentagon thought, people can think outside the military box, might have good suggestions for the military. Cass Sunstein was on that board. Quite a few other Jews, like Walter Isaacson, who's the director of the Aspen Institute. It's implicated in COVID quite a lot.
Mm.
And
virtually all their funding comes from government, I understand. So it's really a government institution.
Aspen?
Yeah, I think.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Like 80% comes from grants from like, linked to the federal government are just so they're just a more or less a kind of a front group, you know,
mm-hmm.
whoever controls our government.
The government's a front group.
Like, well, at least we elect her, so it's okay. Well, no, it's not quite that simple. Unfortunately, we don't control our government, nor does it represent our interests. So.
And Cass Sunstein calls that choice architecture. Like, they provide the choices of candidates.
Well, that's like in the spirit of Walter Lippmann, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
I mean, democracy. That's the problem, you know, the idea of public opinion. And he even said there is no really genuine, organic, real public opinion. Public opinion is created mm-hmm. in any mass society. And of course, if you're going to pay lip service to democracy and have messy things like elections, you better damn well control public opinion mm-hmm. and manipulate people's thoughts. It's like, well, that's nice. That's the that's our democracy. You know.
And control the candidates.
Yeah. Yep, control the candidates in any way, shape, or form. Whether it's just what they can say, what they can think, you know, they don't even think anymore. Look at Joe Biden; they don't even have candidates they can even think.
Jeez,
no. You know, but you know,
the stupider the better. A couple other names here: Tal Zaks, was the chief medical officer for Moderna. He's another covert COVID Jew. Mm-hmm. I use the word covert because they're just not featured as being Jewish, which is what I do in the book, and for good reason. Let's see, what can we say about him? He said he used the phrase hacking the software of life in a 2017 speech using gene editing. So they're all about, manipulation of the human genome, transhumanism.
Mm-hmm.
And the Pentagon bought a half billion doses for $9 billion of the Moderna vaccine in August of 2020. So Zacks helped arrange the contract. Then I'm going to leave off Klaus Schwab. I speculate in this chapter whether Schwab is Jewish just because of his honorary membership in the Ben-Gurion University. And he's a member of the Peres Center for Peace, Shimon Peres, former Israeli prime minister. And he was at the synagogue of Rabbi Arthur Schneier, the Parkey Synagogue, on 9/11 when that event occurred. So just happened to be in New York at that time. But, his father worked for Escher Weiss, the model National Socialist Company, and some people, including Johnny Vedmore at Unlimited Hangout, are featuring Klaus's father as a Nazi. But mm-hmm. later on, there's other evidence that his mother was Jewish, and then there's more evidence that questions that. So I'm leaving Klaus Schwab as a possible crypto-Jew. But he's certainly, later on, I'll talk about how his mentors, his handlers are all Jews. Not all, but mostly. So just to whip through chapter 6, more covert COVID Jews: Albert Bourla, CEO of Pfizer; Michael Dolsten, Pfizer chief science officer; Dr. Drew the Jew Wiseman. He's the one that claims to have invented the technology that made the Pfizer vaccine possible, the lipid nanoparticles. A lot of people say that was, and he does himself, remind me his name, he's pretty prominent, saying he invented it.
McCullough?
No, it skips my mind. But it turns out Wiseman stabilized the nanoparticles. Robert Malone.
Malone, that's right. Yeah, okay. Not M, yeah. M confused.
They weren't able to stabilize it, but Drew Wiseman was. He was working at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Ronald Perelman being a particularly corrupt and deceitful hedge fund manager, billionaire, and Jewish, of course. So the Perelman School of Medicine at UPenn, I consider a epicenter of evil, like Johns Hopkins University School of mm-hmm. Public Health and the Bloomberg School of Public Health. And there's a few others.
Well, anything... Yeah, you have to be very skeptical now of sort of the philanthropy, because that's really is a cover for high level crime. That,
right.
The Rockefeller Foundation and these things, or the General Education Board, various Jewish foundations, these things. What's his name? The guy who's funding all the national monument sites, who's founder of the.
David Rubenstein.
David Rubenstein, yeah, the Carlyle Group, and he's using that philanthropy to more or less engage in anti-white propaganda, racial agitation, and again, all in the name of philanthropy, the same way that medical research is being used for the purposes of monopolization.
Yes, he's in the book twice, David Rubenstein. He's the chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's also on the board of the World Economic Forum, which is another chapter, Jews of the World Economic Forum.
Mm-hmm.
But just to finish with this chapter, Susan Ellenberg is a professor of biostatistics and epidemiology at Perelman School of Medicine, UPenn, and she was on the data safety monitoring board for the vaccine trials. Just rubber stamped them. Sure, pass them on through. There were other Jews on that board as well. So, and then we mentioned earlier obscuring the Jewish problem in alt media, chapter 7. This is a lot about how Jews are involved in online censorship, blacklisting online content creators and promoters, in this case, Dr. Joseph Mercola, as well as the Children's Health Defense of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., mm-hmm. who I thought were both doing great reporting on COVID and vaccines, but they were slammed by a publicist group, NewsGuard, and the Paley Center for Media. And I know Joseph Mercola wrote about this, but he obscured the fact that all three of those organizations are dominated by Jews, the founders, the funders, you know, the managers, the editors, almost overwhelmingly Jewish.
Isn't there also a group that's concerned with what they call digital hate?
Yes, I mentioned that here.
Whenever I hear the word hate being abused, I assume the Jews are behind it, right? ADL. It's got to be an ADL operation.
Yeah. That's a good rule of thumb. The Center for Countering Digital Hate is a, it's not a British government agency. I think it's a nonprofit in Britain. Yes, it advocates for big tech to stop providing services to those who promote hate and disinformation, including, they specify, neo-Nazis and anti-vaxxers.
It's just, well, you know, they hang out in the same club.
Well, yes. <It's> like... I mean, for heaven's sake, they actually specify these groups, like, stop providing. But publicist group is in France, but it's not French. It's dominated by Jews.
I can just see, like, a homeschooling mom hanging out with a bunch of brown shirts.
It really is absurd, and it's laughable, although... It's serious.
Yeah.
If you can laugh at it, you can live with it, but we can't live with any of this. A publicist group, Maurice Levy is the CEO. He's Jewish. Here's the interesting thing. The board of whatever they call it, the board of supervisors of the publicist group, claims it's among the most diverse and representative, you know, inclusive of all the different types. But it's 60%, it's 75% Jewish. Excuse me, let me get this right. There's 13 people on the board, 6 men and 6 women, 8 are independent and 8 are foreign. This is all its diversity. One of the first groups to ensure male-female parity on its board. But it's made up of 60% Jews. 4 are in the same Jewish family, and 2 of them are in the leadership roles, chairman and vice chair. So I would say rather than... what do they call it? Equity, inclusion, and diversity. It's nepotism and in-group preference.
Yes.
It's 60% Jews, and they call it diverse. You know, it's just insane. So.
Well, it's the data. They're smart and they work hard.
Uh huh.
You know, and at this point, they have to be the right sex or, you know. Ethnicity or sexual orientation. I don't know how many homosexuals or transgendered people are on the board. That's,
yes.
But they all have to be Jewish too. But that's or they claim.
We're not told that.
Yeah.
So the CEO is Arthur Sadoun. He's Jewish, and his wife, wrote a hit piece on Marine Le Pen, the French nationalist, and Le Pen reacted and responded by claiming that the entire publicist management belonged to an exclusive caste estranged from most French. And everyone knew who she was talking about. But she didn't say it. So that's publicist group. NewsGuard, JewsGuard, I call it. NewsGuard is an online gatekeeper with assigns like ratings to different sites for their credibility and transparency. And, of course, Joseph Mercola and Children's Health Defense get a red flag.
Mm-hmm.
They're rated like the worst. And then Mercola mentions the Paley Center for Media. We mentioned William Paley, the founder of CBS. He worked in the Office of War Information mm-hmm. in World War II in psychological warfare. And then he went on to like expand CBS. Do you want like a psychological warfare Jew running major media like CBS TV and movie making and mm-hmm. radio? So that's Paley Center, major power. Henry Kissinger is a fellow there. You know, he's a board member. They organized a council summit. They call themselves the Davos of Media. And the 2020 keynote speaker was Tedros from the World Health Organization.
Oh, yes.
So they're very inclusive, but Joseph Mercola and Robert F. Kennedy from Children's Health Defense are not included. They wouldn't fit in well with Kissinger and Tedros.
That's one thing you get in all these organizations is you'd think there'd be like vigorous debate, and there really isn't. That's one thing you saw at like Davos, where you have these conferences where questions are asked, and no one ever seems to be challenged or stuck on a question. And everything's it's very friendly. And I was listening to what's his name? He's a German economist who wrote the book The Princes of Yen.
Don't know it.
And it's a very good book. He talks about how central bankers, how they're selected, and how central bankers are used to there's no public consensus or oversight over these bankers, and how it can be used to overhaul a society by more or less crashing an economy and these things. And he points out what happened in Japan in the 1990s. But anyway, he was talking in the course of talking about some of his research and his ideas. He said he was invited to Davos when he was a young man, like the early 2000s. And he said, wow, this is great. This is exciting. Get to go to Davos and eat a lot of good food and see all these famous people and rub elbows with them. And then you get to ask questions. And at the time, I think GMOs was the issue. And he raised he was asking, I think it was, Larry Summers. Larry Summers, I think it was. Larry Summers was there. And he started going into some of these questions about GMOs. And it wasn't really on script. And they couldn't answer the question. And the next day, he raised his hands, asked more questions, and no one would pick him.
Right.
And then he was never invited back.
No. No, it was a narrative control.
Yeah. And so he thought, yeah, all these smart people. They're not smart. It's just that everything's controlled. And it's, again, it's a narrative control script. You have to stick to it. And if you deviate from it, you won't be invited back, and you won't be allowed to ask any more questions.
And that's right. And that's a good synchronicity. Chapter 8 is, I call Jews of the World Economic Forum. Some of these chapters I submitted as essays to the OccidentalObserver.net in the course of 2020 and 2021. And I should mention, that's why I call the subtitle An Inquest Chronicle, because I stick to the years 2020 and 2021.
Mm-hmm.
With a couple of exceptions for 2022. Just to document those 2 years as like among the most epic in human history, the COVID developments were world transformative. But the editor at OccidentalObserver.net, Kevin McDonald, changed the title. And I'm not clear why, but I trust Dr. McDonald. He's very experienced in these matters. He's been the subject or object of being accused of an anti-Semite for a long time. So he changed the title to The Not-So-Friendly Folks at the World Economic Forum, which I just, I kind of cringed at that, but I changed it back. And all of the chapters in the book are in the original form. Many of the essays were changed and edited. So I go straight with it, Jews of the World Economic Forum. And we're talking about the Board of Trustees, which has 31 exceptional individuals who act as guardians of its mission and values and oversee the forum's work in promoting true global citizenship. Is that the forum's work, promoting global citizenship? Well, these 31 board members, of them, at least 6 are Jews, and very powerful, influential Jews, starting with Leo Raphael Rafe, who is the president of MIT, who is developing trustworthy and socially responsible AI, where the Media Lab took donations from Jeffrey Epstein. And Rafe had to say that was deeply disturbing. Also, David Rubenstein, we've mentioned him, the founder and co-founder and executive of the Carlyle Group, a huge investment bank. And they take investments from George Soros, who's dodging taxes, and they own Booz Allen Hamilton and much of the war industry. There's a lot to say about Carlyle Group. Mark Benioff, the founder of Salesforce, a huge sort of software rental business. Their goal is that all software will be rented and no longer owned. Mm-hmm. Mark Benioff helped to found Oracle, which is at the core of like mass surveillance in the U.S. He owns Time Magazine at this point, more like mind control. Larry Fink is on the board, BlackRock CEO. Their managed assets reached $10 trillion in 2022. He issues his letters to CEOs, which is more like orders. Every year he sends out the letters to CEOs. But because BlackRock owns enough stock in all the corporations that if they sell it off, it collapses their stock, his letters are more like orders. Like, this is what you're going to do this year, CEOs. And Larry Fink says so. And a lot of them are about climate change. Then there's, how do you say this name? Orit Gadish. She's they call her the chairman of Bain Consultancy. Formerly, the chairman was Mitt Romney. Mm-hmm. And she was trained in the IDF, and she says her training in the IDF helps her lead Bain. You know, so in the same way that it's the IDF, you know, is slow genociding the Palestinians, then the World Economic Forum can, you know, with Orit Gadish's input, can conduct this slow genocide on the world population with the vaccine bioweapon.
Yeah, they have a strange idea of defense.
Mm-hmm. It's not a conflict. It's really what you call asymmetrical warfare. So there's Orit Gadish. Her father was in the IDF as a general. Peter Brabeck Letmathi. I can only speculate that he's Jewish. He's on the board of the World Economic Forum. He's the CEO of Nestle, and their agenda seems to be control of the world's potable water.
Mm-hmm.
He was a chairman of the Water Resource Group at the World Bank, and he won the Jubilee Award, Israel's, you know, Service to Israel Award, for his work in the food category. Those are the Jews that I see on the World Economic Forum. There's a few philo-Semites like Peter Maurer, who's the International Committee of the Red Cross director, who was promoting the Holocaust narrative and, you know, avoiding looking at the human rights violations that the Red Cross should be involved with in the, you know, the Israeli persecution of Palestinians.
That's interesting because wasn't the Red Cross report back in the 40s, which estimated like 300,000 dead? Not 6 million.
Yes, it's interesting you say that. I actually address that in this chapter. The International Committee of the Red Cross in 1947 announced the tally of deaths in the German prisons through the war and for 2 years beyond into 1947 as 271,301. They didn't guess. So Peter Maurer, you know, the current director of the Red Cross, he was meeting with the Israeli Council on Foreign Relations, and where the World Jewish Congress was present, and they were both mentioning records and archives from the Holocaust and how the Red Cross failed to try hard enough to, you know, rescue Jews from the Holocaust, and they're referring to records and archives, which of course refers to the 6 million number.
Mm-hmm.
Completely covering over the 271,000 number that the Red Cross itself presented.
The importance there is the 271,000 number, however grim, would be in line with how many deaths you'd get overall with the war itself, with the conditions in the camps. And it doesn't testify or support the idea that there's some sort of industrial level killing or genocidal program, which is these are deaths caused by the course of the war. The conditions in the camps are, of course, aggravated by the war, particularly the bombing campaign and the blockading of Germany. And right. Position became more desperate in the war of 1944-45, the condition of the camps became worse as well, as they became worse all throughout Germany.
and typhus was spreading. That was a big killer. Mm-hmm. So the 271,000 is by no means anywhere near a majority of Jews. There are many other racial or religious groups. So, you know, the number is even smaller than that.
It doesn't speak of an intentional genocidal, you know, killing machine that we're given. Yeah. But,
no. All by itself.
I think half, I think like a third or half of that died in one night, a couple nights in Dresden, you know, so.
Right.
Yeah.
Just for comparative purposes, but I address once again whether Klaus Schwab is Jewish in this chapter. You know, the executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, because new information had emerged. The essay by Johnny Vedmore at an Unlimited Hangout, Schwab Family Values, which identifies Klaus Schwab's father Eugene as German, and even possibly a Nazi.
I think if that article makes some interesting connections. Again, a lot of the stuff, these articles aren't so much incorrect as are insufficient. He makes a connection between that and also Schwab's ties to Kissinger, right, and the CIA, meaning that the Davos, he suggests Davos is sort of a setup by the CIA, whatever that means, which it may not be incorrect, but then again, what is CIA? You know?
They conducted a seminar at Harvard, and Kissinger organized it. And he's Jewish, of course, and Herman Kahn was another major influence or mentor of Klaus Schwab. He's Jewish. Mm-hmm. Schwab said the book The American Challenge by Jean-Jacques Servan-Schreiber was a great influence on him. He's Jewish.
But then we're supposed to worry about Schwab's Nazi connections?
Yeah, exactly. So I go through, Vedmore's, the names and influences he mentioned in his essay and identify which ones are possibly Jewish. So I'm undecided on whether Schwab's mother was Jewish. There was some researchers claimed she definitely was. Valentin Katasonov was quoted by other online sources claiming Schwab's mother was Jewish. And then, Forbidden Knowledge TV had an interview with Michael McKibben from Leader Technologies. They claimed they were researching this and found Emma Gisela Tequila Schwab was Klaus's mother and she was Jewish. But then there was an update later on. I got a communication from Lex Weiser at Dystopian Living Substack page. He saw my essay, Klaus Schwab is a Jew, on the Substack, my Substack, Taboo Truth. And he presented evidence that there was a different Gisela Schwab who emigrated into the U.S. in 1938. Same year, same name. It's like, but different, So it's still unsure, but by no means is it unsure that Schwab had major influence from Jews, Kissinger, Kahn, and quite a few others. So, Tim, I don't know how much more time we have. Chapter 9 is the president's anti-white Jewish speechwriter, who is Carolyn Reichel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when you hear Biden say, the greatest threat to the homeland is white supremacy terrorism, that's because Carolyn Reichel is his speechwriter. She was Biden's speechwriter when he was vice president, and she was Hillary Clinton's speechwriter when she was Secretary of State. So, you know, not a newcomer. Chapter 10, Science Tikkun, the Talmudic controlled doctrine of Peter Hotez. Peter Hotez is being considered for Anthony Fauci's old position, which would be an atrocity. It would just be a horror. This guy is a deranged, like, pro-vax maniac.
He refuses to debate people who are skeptical of vaccines. Well, it's an interesting position to take. You're so dumb, I don't even want to talk to you. You're so crazy.
You definitely lose, so it's a good strategy. He's written the most inflammatory, like, hostile essays. And
didn't he propose a law that make it illegal to criticize Anthony Fauci or something?
Well, he opposed the law that Marjorie Taylor Greene brought to try to investigate Fauci.
Uh-huh.
He said that was like, you know, witch hunting and, you know, assaulting a credible U.S. scientist. So he's just a madman. But the point here is he's applying the concept, the Talmudic concept of tikkun olam, which really genuinely means completing the world, because the Jewish God Yahweh left the world incomplete, and the Jews are obligated and empowered to complete the world on Yahweh's behalf.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Talmudic concept of tikkun olam, and Peter Hotez is promoting it. It's just raving madness.
Which is why you look at any destructive move in the past 60, 75, 100 years in the West, the principal agents are spearheading those causes are often Jews or overwhelmingly Jewish.
And claim they're fixing the world or mm-hmm. completing the world. Most likely not really believing that, but using it as a pretext. And this guy, Peter Hotez, is promoting vaccines under that doctrine, which I think is very dangerous.
Yeah, I saw a clip of today of Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist for the New York Times, and he was talking about white anger. And he's explaining it, and he's saying, what's the cause for this white anger? It's because whites are losing power. They're losing their country because of demographics, diversity. These things are just happening, by the way. They're just happening. It's like an act of nature, an act of God. No one's really behind it. It's just happening. And he says, you know, they sense they're losing their power, and some are getting rather cantankerous about it, and they're not willing to accept that their time's come and gone.
Yes.
Wait a second. We live in an age where everyone wants to be empowered, but you're actively saying that ethnic whites need to be disempowered, presumably so they can be destroyed, I guess, or be denied their rights, or you know, be discriminated against and victimized. And what group voluntarily gives away their power? So they, you know, obviously, if you don't have power, you don't have the power to defend your interests. And he's just openly talking about it. Now you've reversed that. You say, if you were someone, if there was an economist there saying, you know, well, the Jews are rather upset. They're getting paranoid. They're getting rather, you know, cantankerous, and mm-hmm. the fact that they're losing their power, and they're not willing to accept that their time has come and gone.
I know.
Obviously, what would be said about that?
There'd be an outrage.
Mm-hmm.
This man, Peter Hotez, actually equates tikkun olam with the New World Order. I mean, literally, he says, ensure that the world's poor continue to receive access to innovation and technologies in this New World Order. He says the New World Order of science and technology gaps affords us an opportunity to expand our science tikkun definitions. He's basically saying the New World Order is a Jew World Order under tikkun olam. I mean, these people are so out front. That's why I feel like I'm compelled to write about this. I want to chronicle this and bring it to a highlight, because it is out in the open. I should roll on here, Chapter 11, Neo-Pharisees of the CDC. I played around with the euphemism. Not as bad as the not-so-friendly folks, but I think we know what we mean by Neo-Pharisees.
Mm-hmm.
The CDC. Of course, Rochelle Walensky was the director during the COVID, and apparently still is. But the CDC was rescued around the year 2000 from, you know, low funding by Bernard Marcus, who's the Jew who owns and operates the Home Depot.
Mm-hmm.
He gave $4 million for the Emergency Response Center after the anthrax attacks of 2001, and then went on to lobby Congress for $1.6 billion more for the CDC to expand into the Leviathan it is today.
Yeah, of course. So, who carried out those anthrax attacks?
Whitney Webb writes the best about that. Yeah. Can you summarize that?
Well, like, the source of it, of course, was from U.S. labs. And remember, originally it was tied to the 9/11 attacks. Tried to blame it on Muslims. Yeah, there's fake notes, right? And then it turns out that the had nothing to do with them. But nevertheless, we're given stories about the 9/11 bombers, some having subcutaneous anthrax, and the link. One odd account is the photographer editor that died down in Florida. The his the editor's boss wife was the real estate agent for Muhammad Atta.
Uh-huh.
It's never been quite explained what all that's about. Or remember the stories of them trying to get crop planes to spray?
Yes.
And that was all tied into the anthrax 9/11, and all that was just forgotten.
Right, another boogeyman.
Yeah.
Spreading disease.
Remember going into asking for a $600,000 loan and threatening to cut the throat of the person who didn't give him the loan. And the stories and all down in Florida. The whole Janet Hopsicka writes about the Muhammad Atta down in Florida hanging out with strippers, mm-hmm. them hanging out with strippers and all. Just none of it seems to make any sense.
No.
Given the
Land writes about that.
Yeah, and so it's kind of something. There's something that's never quite explained. But again, the source of the anthrax was were the U.S. labs, the proving grounds. I forget the name. Was it the Doug? What was the name of the proving ground? It was linked back to, and also the research lab in Maryland. You know, that was the strain. Then, of course, they blame it on Saddam Hussein.
Yes. Well, never let a good crisis go to waste, as the Jew Rahm Emanuel said.
Mm-hmm.
So after the anthrax attacks, at the time, Jeffrey Copeland was the CDC director. He's Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And the Congress gave additional funding to the CDC to deal with the anthrax crisis. And Copeland basically pilfered it. He disappeared it. You know, he was accused of basically stealing the extra money. And so that was a previous Jewish director of the CDC. I go through the roster, Jews at the CDC. You know, I call Rochelle Walensky a baby killer because she had urged pregnant people.
Mm-hmm.
She wouldn't say mothers or women. To get vaccinated for COVID, and it was urgent based on a study the CDC did. Well, I checked out the study, and it didn't say that. It said they need more data. They only had any data for like the first trimester and only from a few states, but there was Walensky pushing COVID vax on pregnant mothers. The research ended up showing that like 21% of pregnant mothers suffered a miscarriage. And 9% like small birth weight and other defects, early birth. So the COVID vaccine was pretty damaging to pregnant mothers and their babies. But Walensky was pushing it. She introduced the term pandemic of the unvaccinated
mm-hmm.
at a July 2021 press briefing where Jeff Zients is the COVID response team coordinator. He's Jewish.
He's now chief of staff for the Biden White House.
Ah, that's right. Promoting upward. Walensky said 97% of hospitalizations from COVID are among the unvaccinated. This was challenged by the CNN reporter, Caitlin Collins, I think. And, you know, they hemmed and hawed and Fauci stepped in and said, well, we don't really know. We don't have enough data. But then it turns out like Israel is the most heavily vaccinated country in the world, yet it has the highest rates of COVID infection. You know, so Walensky was way off base. This was complete propaganda, the pandemic of the unvaccinated. So I mentioned Jeffrey Copeland. He was a CDC director in the 90s through 2001. He resigned under accusations of misappropriating congressional funds. Thomas Frieden was the 2009 CDC director. He was threatened with removal for incompetence during the Ebola scare. And he eventually had to resign in 2019 for like sexual harassment and sexual assault. You know, typical, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Shukat was the temporary director when during these transitions. She's Jewish. She said, we certainly think it should be easier to get a vaccine than to get an exemption. At the time, only 1.7% of kindergartners had exemptions. A lot of these Jewish CDC directors, actually all of them, came up in the ranks through the Epidemic Intelligence Service.
Yeah, that's an interesting outfit.
Do you know the writing of John Rappaport on them?
He's done a fair amount of research on that and why it was created and they pretty much staff the various health departments, agencies, and they indoctrinate them to believe, of course, that the source of disease is always some virus out there that they have to hunt down. And he thinks that it's sort of a laundering operation where to blame outbreaks or disease areas of disease on God, more or less, a virus as opposed natural occurring as opposed to toxic exposure, these things, poisons.
Yes.
Yeah. Which you can infer if you actually investigate these various aspects, like the swine flu outbreak was at a massive a pig farm in Mexico, which didn't have proper sanitation.
Right.
Same thing in Africa, where any number of things can cause these diseases, but they blame it. Ebola, like hemorrhaging, can be anything. So you have vague or general symptoms that can be a product of exposure to pesticides, toxins, disease, caused by through malnutrition.
Yeah.
Exposure vaccines. To chemical war, that sort of thing. Vaccines, another thing, yeah, which is a form of interpret vaccines as sort of exposure to toxins or a form of biological warfare. It depends on
absolutely.
Your position.
On. Yep, that's the EIS.
Yeah.
Epidemic Intelligence Service, and all these Jewish CDC directors came through that program.
So they're indoctrinated to think that way. Find the virus. Blame it on the virus and scare the hell out of the world.
That's right.
Same thing. Remember, what was that, Zika?
Oh, yeah.
Like 2013 or 12 or 13, and everyone was just terrified. Turns out there was nothing. I mean, nothing. The whole thing with the shrunken, with the small head or something.
And microcephaly. That was 2016 because it was the Brazilian Olympics.
Yeah.
And the Brazilian government was pouring.
And they were telling women to have abortions.
Excuse me?
They were telling Brazilian women to have abortions. Unless you have a baby with microcephaly,
don't conceive. You might have it was obviously a population control plan.
Yeah,
the Brazilian government was dumping pyroproxifen larvicide into the drinking water.
Mm-hmm.
That was causing the birth defects. Claiming they want to reduce the mosquitoes for the Olympics, all the international visitors.
Yeah. And then was it Bill Gates comes out with some sort of genetically modified mosquito to deliver vaccines?
Yes.
You're a creep.
That's our solution. So the Epidemic Intelligence Service is only one of 17 intelligence services in the United States, and they're overseen by the Director of National Security. Biden's director is Avril Haines. She's Jewish. And mm-hmm. Trump's was Richard Grenell. He was young, homosexual, and mm-hmm. Jewish.
These are the people in charge of our public health.
Right.
By the way, national security, public health. So public health, that's nothing that John Rappaport writes about is something that I was kind of familiar with going into the whole COVID, so it made me skeptical about the reaction and everything. The idea that public health itself is apolitical or medical complex when it's nothing, it's anything but actually. And it's a perfect cover for psychological warfare or a political move to impose a dictatorship through a medical dictatorship is what we got. And after all, you can't question the experts. Dr. Fauci's a doctor. He's an expert, right? He's been at this for 40 years. He's been pushing paper and spending other people's money for 40 years. So we have to listen to him.
Right. I mean, the medical system has emerged as the primary vector for this world-controlled agenda. And the Club of Rome said that back in the 70s.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let me read the final paragraph of this chapter verbatim here. Quote, somehow we must explain the flagrant violations of basic science and medicine, sound public health policy, and genuine concern for the well-being of the American people perpetrated by the CDC. An examination of the presence of powerful Jews in influential positions at this most central of all U.S. government agencies addressing COVID provides an explanation.
Yeah.
So, covert Jews.
It's a cognitive shortcut, as they say.
let me check in on our time, Tim. I have three other chapters.
Yeah, go ahead.
Four. We're about an hour in here, so. It'd be great to just summarize each of the chapters and
mm-hmm.
and conclude. So that's the core of the book, the eight chapters focus on the Jewish issue within COVID. And I still address that in the next section. I think the next 12, 13, three chapters are other influences, including Bill Gates. So chapter 12, COVID evil, satanic references in the coronavirus scamdemic. This was rejected by the Occidental Observer, but I felt it was important to include it. You know, it reveals a kind of conspiracy theory of a satanic cult that has an influence. And I think that's quite credible.
Yeah, I think is what they're proposing is something so audacious, so monstrous, so evil that it has to, you'd have to think there's some sort of malevolent spiritual force behind it all.
And a kind of satanic ideology.
Yeah.
Or religious influence.
Synagogue of Satan.
Yes, exactly. And I chronicle that here. The HR 6666, you might remember this.
Just a coincidence.
The Trace Act.
Yes.
Testing, reaching, and contacting everyone. Here's where the Aspen Institute comes in again. They held a conference in Rwanda, along with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And Bobby Rush, the black senator from Illinois, was it, attended?
I think did he sponsor the bill or something? Or he was a sponsor, yes. A sponsor of it.
Yeah. He was a sponsor. Came back and sponsored. $100 billion was going to be allocated for, you know, what I call plague sniffers.
I'm sure he wrote the bill.
Well,
the same way that Senator Fetterman is writing bills. So
yes, his name is on it. They were going to distribute this money down to the local level, churches, schools, nonprofits, and send out these trained plague sniffers.
Yeah, that's how you get consensus.
That'll do it. That's a lot of money.
Yes.
At a time when people were out of work from the lockdown. Mm-hmm. So they were it provides for like approaching us at our residences, at our front doors, you know, to ask people like, okay, we've identified you as possibly infected and we want to know where you've been. Who have you visited? So I say, if I'm visited by a plague sniffer at my door, I'll tell them I visited the offices of Anthony Fauci, Microsoft, you know, and I sent letters sealed with my infected spit to the bill's sponsors, you know, Senator Cohen, Wasserman Schultz, Raskin, all Jews.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, go trace those people. That's where I've been. And, you know, so 666, as you know, it's from Revelations chapter 13, verse 16 to 18. All people, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, must receive a mark on their forehead or right hand, lest they not buy nor sell. The number of the beast is the number of a man, and that number is 666.
Yeah, so just as a PR move, you'd number your bill with 6666. So
the number of the beast. Yeah. There it is. There's other examples of 666, the Google Chrome logo, and the World Economic Forum. It's not a logo, it's the words World Economic Forum with that arcing slash,
mm-hmm.
that kind of arc that goes through the O's. On the left side of each O, making each one into a six. It's really quite clear in the World Economic Forum slogan, I guess, name.
Is it true? I don't know if this is true. I heard that the first Apple computer went for $666.
I hadn't heard that.
That might be apocryphal. I don't know. But
It's a signaling. It's a Freemasonic signal number. We have the enzyme luciferase was used in the development of the vaccines, and particularly the vaccine tracking. It's like a glow-in-the-dark enzyme. I mentioned Marina Abramović.
Oh, yeah, the Pizzagate lady. Remember?
Spirit cooking witch.
Spirit cooking and all that stuff, yes.
Cannibalism and blood drinking, parties. It's like, she was featured in a one-minute advertisement for Microsoft's virtual reality goggles.
Naturally.
And this ad was played first on Good Friday, 2020.
Naturally.
You know, it got 25,000 thumbs down, so they removed it. YouTube put it on private viewing only. So there's your tie-in with Marina. At first I thought she was Jewish, but I found out since that she's Serbian.
Yeah.
I submitted an update of the files of my book in the new edition.
Wasn't she the one like hosting parties with Well, there were mentions and emails with Hillary Clinton, but then what's his name? The you know, his brother. Remember the whole spirit, the whole Pizzagate thing.
Yes.
Podestas.
Podesta. Okay.
Yeah, the Podestas. Yeah, the Podestas, and there's all types of references. And apparently, she hosted. Didn't she host parties with them or something?
I didn't find that in my research.
Maybe I confused it. I know she had celebrities. Somehow she was sought after for some reason. So, but in those circles, like somebody was like, it was thought strange that someone like Podesta, who's like involved in realpolitik, is involved in spirit cooking. I remember thinking at the time, yeah. You know, that along with your brother's taste in art is very, very, it's like, right.
You know. Yeah, he had like really disturbing art from serial killers.
Yeah, they're saying, well, you can't judge them from their ethnic collector. Yeah, you can. What are you talking about?
Uh-huh. Hey, like, I, speaking of art, I remember when you and Joe Atwill on your program talked about how Marina Abramović was photographed with Jacob Rothschild in front of the painting Satan Summons His Legions.
Yeah, just art, just a, you know, funny taste.
So, satanic references.
Yeah.
Jacob Rothschild, he's about as evil as you can get. Now, here's an interesting thing about Bill Gates. The Gates Foundation funded the Lucis Trust, mm-hmm. which was led by Alice Bailey, who's a protege of Madame Blavatsky, the Jewish Satanist, you know, the Theosophical Society. Mm-hmm. And the Lucis Trust ran the Lucifer Publishing Company. The Gates Foundation is listed as in the financial group of an associated group to the Lucis Publishing, known as New Group of World Servers. So Gates Foundation is funding the New Group of World Servers, which is working to implement, quote unquote, the plan, which includes, quote, building the new world order. And people at Gates' level are known as, they are known for their harmless, constructive, and inclusive qualities. They carry forward activities that benefit humanity as a whole and mold public opinion. So above the New Group of World Servers is a group called the Custodians of the Plan. And I couldn't find their name, so I don't know if they're Jewish, but their plan is clearly ill will mm-hmm. towards humanity.
Well, I think at least what I gather is their plan, at least part of achieving their plan, is just provoking one crisis after another, whether, you know, so they can get a great reset of one form or another. Foment wars and banking crises, financial crises, and blame it on like nation states and democracy and people. And when, you know, at every stage they're controlling it, you know.
Oh, yeah. They say the plan is building the new world order, which is exactly what you described.
Mm-hmm. Build back better, right?
Yes.
Forge us a great opportunity.
Here's something else that you and Joe talked about, the 33 A's that. And the genome sequence,
mm-hmm.
you know, the genome sequence for SARS-CoV-2 is about 30,000 letters, A, C, G, T. But it ends with 33 A's in a row, which is, seems really weird and very unusual. So when I heard you say that on Powers and Principalities, I started to research it. And I found the genome listing on the National Center for Biotechnology Information. And I found that, you know, the Chinese researchers listed it. They actually listed it three times, January 12th, January 14th, and January 17th, each time changing the name until it became SARS-CoV-2.
Mm-hmm.
And by the third time, the replacement listing, one of the Chinese researchers, all of them were Chinese, but then one of them was omitted and an Anglo name was inserted, and his name was E.C. Holmes. So I looked up this guy. Why is E.C. Holmes suddenly on the genome listing, you know, study? Who is this man? Well, he's a virologist and epidemiologist at Sydney University in Australia, and he was inducted into the Royal Society in 2017. So the Royal Society is the world's oldest scientific advocacy, you know, group. They were founded in 1660, and they're all Freemasons, the founders. So I say the Royal Society is still a Freemasonic society that's controlling medicine and, you know, medical science.
Yeah, and it's all about sort of occulted information and knowledge and technology.
So E.C. Holmes was placed on this research group to install the 33 A's at the end of the genome sequence as a kind of Freemasonic signal. Mm-hmm. You know, they're letting us know. It's the revelation of the method. They want us to know that this is all a satanic hoax. That's my theory. So there's more to say about, even just very recently, there was a referral to a research paper that claimed SARS-CoV-2 could not possibly be, you know, genetically engineered. It's a natural thing. Mm-hmm. One of the authors of that was E.C. Holmes. So let me just close with my final sentence in this chapter. The entire coronavirus scenario is not just a hoax or scam. It is the blatant projection of evil into our world. Any cooperation with the entire coronavirus phenomenon is cooperation with evil. We must reject it wholesale for good. Okay. Chapter 13 is what I mentioned at the beginning, Tim. Oregon governor advised by Bill Gates and patent lawyers, which I overheard you reading from back in the spring of 2020. Mm-hmm. How did you select that for reporting on? You saw it at the Occidental Observer.
Well, I often will read that site, read the articles at that site. But I think at the time I was looking into how it was being coordinated and sort of making the connections. And, you know, because there was almost, you know, the whole world shut down, as they say. You know, 3 billion people were put into, quote, lockdown. And it seemed all very coordinated. And of course, one way to look at that is, well, it appears coordinated because various public health authorities are looking at the same evidence and are honestly declaring a public health emergency. And this is what you do. But then I was looking at what they were proposing was completely contrary to my understanding of epidemiology, you know, layman's understanding, even good health. Like even in spring came, telling people to stay inside, don't get vitamin D, don't get exercise, eat junk food. You know, it's like none of this is good advice in any situation. And no. You never quarantine healthy people. And this isn't the way that viruses are. At least I'm told viruses operate. You know, it becomes endemic, it becomes benign, and it goes away. And that's how you deal with it. So it just didn't make any sense. I did find out that some of the initial claims of you know, some of the panic that we saw, like in Italy, and you know, the fact that the media was using file footage of various hospitals and misrepresenting to the public to create this panicky situation, the death rate, the increased death rate we weren't seeing, and the people that were dying were in a group that you'd expect to die over 80, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So this must be coordinated. Then all of a sudden it came out that, well, it has been coordinated. Imperial College of London, Bill Gates, World Health Organization, Johns Hopkins. And then it finds out that so many of the people at the state level who are advising various governors to lock down have ties to Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation money, mm-hmm. largesse. And then we found out about Event 201, where they kind of game this very scenario, where they control the media. They called it the infodemic. So they have to control the narrative, and you control the narrative by more or less having assets or agents in media and public health, and that's how this thing was coordinated. And the when you pointed out Oregon, I thought that was like kind of a case study.
Yes,
one state is an example how it's being coordinated. This stuff is being planned for, you know, years, if not decades. So they've had years to get this ready. And then you had the economic problems in 2019, which seemed to be the time. Okay, let's load the boom now, and we can create that the pandemic mm-hmm. can be the excuse for this the deal with the financial problems that we're seeing today. Actually, the 2019 Jackson Hole meeting, where BlackRock unveiled this plan, which would then became policy in March 2020, supposed to deal with the economic effects of the lockdown, with the, you know, with the whole idea with the going direct. And, you know, the whole happened to the bond market, the repo market. So they could lock everything down, bail everything out, not worry about a run on the dollar, or a an inflationary crisis because of the collapse of the dollar, because it's all because of the pandemic. Yeah.
That was a great summary, Tim. That's one of your strengths.
Oh, I thought I was rambling. That's good.
No, that was coordinated and focused. It's a very excellent summary of the whole COVID phenomenon. This chapter focuses on Institute for Disease Modeling and the intellectual ventures.
Mm-hmm.
And because I found out, I was living in Oregon at the time, and I found out the governor was referring to basically a research paper, a recommendation paper provided by the Institute for Disease Modeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was recommending all the extreme lockdown measures, the aggressive interventions. And so I said, well, what is this, IDM? And I went researching that. I found out it was a nonprofit computer modeling, disease computer modeling, you know, center in Bellevue, Washington. And it gets its funding from the Global Good Fund. And the Global Good Fund gets all of its money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. You know, so I researched the authors. There were four authors of this paper that was advising the Oregon governor. It's called COVID-19 Intervention Effectiveness and Epidemic Trends for Oregon, a Model-Based Analysis. And these godforsaken computer models, they're just...
Yes.
They're just hysteria, you know. They're just so, you know, discredited.
Neil Ferguson, right?
Right. They're obviously sales pitches for fear appeals for selling vaccines.
And it turns out that his outfit, the Imperial College of London, is a what they call it, a green sustainability university, and that itself, when you're talking about sustainability, like I have a niece who has a degree in sustainability. Of course, she's got nothing. She's not employed doing that at all. But she's been indoctrinated.
Yeah. You know, how sustainable is that?
You know, sustainable. And so then they create a cohort of people who think this way, and they endow chairs in universities, all funding through outfits like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It's the same model with the General Education Board of Rockefellers in the 1903 or four when they
created that degree. So, I mean, the four authors are Cliff Kerr. He was getting funding from DARPA. You know, the intelligence, speculative science and technology for military applications. He worked for he got funding from the Gates Foundation. Brittany Hagedorn is one of the authors. She researches the cost effectiveness of vaccines, including one study in where she assessed whether it would be cheaper to inject African children with another measles vaccine instead of trying to find out if they'd already had enough. You know, which was cheaper. It's like, good God.
It's like Larry Summers who said it's okay to dump toxic waste in Africa because the lifespans are short anyway.
Oh, right. It's like, you know, if it costs less, then sure.
Mm-hmm.
Dina Mistry.
By the way, then he's kicked out of Harvard for saying that women aren't as good at math as men. That's his crime.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I can rape Russia, rob Russia. I can talk about killing kids in Africa, dumping our waste there, and write memos how that's acceptable. But I suggest that women might not be as good as men. As men.
Right. So he went on to be the Secretary of the Treasury, or was that beforehand?
Yeah. Well, that was before, I think. Okay. Wait. Remember? Yeah. But it was time the Committee to Save the World. It was Alan Greenspan, Larry Summers, and Robert Rubin.
Yeah, what could go wrong? Those are world savers.
What's the pattern in all those three guys?
Mm-hmm. Right. The pattern in these authors is funding from the Gates Foundation. Mm-hmm. Dina Mistry is an author. She's studies surveilling our internet activity to track our spreading of disease. And she, in one paper, she noted the growing need for realism in addressing complex public health questions. So it's reassuring to know that realism is now a research parameter. And Daniel Klein, he's probably the foremost author of this paper. He's Jewish. The IDM senior research manager develops the computer models. Now, this research paper that's advising the Oregon governor, six of the nine references, the footnotes that it relies on, come from studies out of China. So we're going to trust the communist Chinese to inform the Oregon governor. That was an outrage. I was very upset by this when I lived in Oregon, and so were other people that read it. But the for-profit aspect of Institute for Disease Modeling is intellectual ventures. I call them intellectual vultures. They're for-profit patent lawyers. You know, they push for innovation and transform industries by buying up clusters of patents in certain, you know, sub industries like diagnostic medical technology and medical treatments. So their founder and CEO of Intellectual Vultures is Nathan Myhrvold. He was the chief technical officer at Microsoft, and he was implicated with Jeffrey Epstein. And Whitney Webb wrote about this. Epstein came to the Intellectual Venture offices with his young girl, Russian models. And Myhrvold spoke openly about borrowing Epstein's jet. He stayed at Epstein's mansions in Florida and New York. And Alan Dershowitz, the Jewish Harvard lawyer, openly accused Myhrvold of having sex with children, which is something, of course, Dershowitz is himself accused of. So here's the guy that runs Intellectual Ventures, you know, the for-profit selling vaccines and medical technology through the fear of pandemics, Nathan Myhrvold. That was just an outrage. You know, Oregon is going to take advice on how to treat the pandemic with the association of this guy. Mm-hmm. What concern does he have for public health?
Yeah, and just think about the caliber, the moral caliber of these people.
And, oh, yeah. You know, what do they care about anyone's health? They're probably happy to see people die and suffer with illness. I think that's part of the evil. They actually get derive a kind of sick thrill out of inflicting harm and death.
Look at like Bill Gates, all his vaccine programs, like in India, where he's paralyzed people, and I think he was kicked out of India, right?
That comes up in the next chapter.
Yeah,
but just to conclude this chapter, I said, Institute for Disease Modeling and intellectual ventures people are more like vultures, in it for money and power, not Oregon's public health. These are the experts from whom Governor Brown is getting her advice in running Oregon during the state of emergency. Gates, Myhrvold, the child rapist, and a bunch of corporate patent lawyers and mad scientists who want to vaccinate and chip the entire world population. These are the technocrats trying to profit and seize power by imposing technological solutions they invent and sell. They see money and power in their ongoing destruction of Oregon's economy, society, and people. They get their studies from communist China to inform their tables and graphs and issue their recommendations to Oregon's governor for continued lockdown apocalypse. I think that sums it up, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the penultimate chapter, for your listeners who might not know, that's a great word. It means not the ultimate, but the second to last. You know, as a writer, I try to acquire new words. Second to last chapter, chapter 14, the Gates Millipus, 1,000 tentacles entangle the nation. And this one, Occidental Observer, a different version of this, posted. So I was in contact with Institute for Disease Modeling by email. They told me they also were advising Washington State, New York City, the White House Council of Economic Advisors, and 3 to 4 other states. You know, so I went researching their influence. Of course, they're advising Washington. Their paper there, April 10th, 2020, physical distancing is working and still needed to prevent COVID-19 resurgence in King, Snohomish, and Pierce counties. King, I think, being where Seattle is.
Mm-hmm.
Researched the authors for the influence from the Gates Foundation. Daniel Klein is another one of them, you know, the Jew from the Oregon paper. Roy Bernstein is Jewish. He works for the Global Burden of Disease Project, which provides policymakers, donors, and other decision makers with the most timely and useful picture of population health. You know, you trust that?
Yeah.
You know, funded by Gates. I won't go through it all here, but
Where's their science about distancing?
Yeah.
That's refuted now, right? That's like the whole thing. There's no basis, scientific basis for that at all.
Right. I thought they derived that from a science project that was submitted to a science fair by a grade school girl.
Yeah, someone's either grade school or no. Come on, don't. That's it was junior high.
Oh, okay. Let's not discredit it too much.
6 feet apart, right? 6 feet apart. I still walk in the stores and see those. That's all. They're starting to wear out now.
Good.
It's just kind of like, man. I still see people drive around with masks in their cars.
Oh no. At the credit union, I try to get them to take down the plastic barricade, and I'm like, is this the new normal, or is this ever going away?
Yeah, there's a chain of grocery stores, the one I usually go to, there's the plastic's gone, but there's one sometimes I go to if I'm on my way back from a job or something, and I'll stop in there, and there's the plastic's still there, but no one's following protocols. It's like...
Right. So it's just collecting... microbes.
Yeah. That it's a surface. That's right. It's just like the masks are, right? For bacteria, right. For real, like bacteriological problems.
It's a fomite.
It's a fomite. Yeah, that's another word we learned during the pandemic.
Yeah, fomite. That's a good one.
And then did you see that one school where the kids were in bubbles?
Oh my goodness!
And it was virtual bubbles. It was like a catacomb of plastic.
That's awful.
It was, this insanity, like no one wrote a memo to do this. What happens is there's enough emergent behavior from this that people will, if you fund it, people will build it more or less, or they'll spend the money. So you had all this COVID money going out. And mm-hmm. whoever designed this was to separate the students in this plexiglass. The only problem is once you sit down at the desk, you can't see the teacher. But it doesn't matter because you had to spend the money, right? You had to spend the money in cleaning products. You had to spend the money. So you just want to spend the money, you know.
Yeah. Cleaning products are worse than the disease.
Yeah. And then city budgets are depending on COVID relief money to pay for things because they don't have a tax base anymore, like Los Angeles or something.
Yes. That's why the Gates Foundation could be so effective in funding these things. They were funding – turns out that New York City was getting advice from the – Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluations, which is even bigger than IDM,
mm-hmm.
and also funded through Global Good and the Gates Foundation.
Who's, by the way, just all in all, he and his, I guess, his co-conspirators are making money hand over fist in the whole COVID narrative. All the technology, this innovative technology, mRNA. Remember the digital tattoo?
Yes.
You know,
I think that had a patent number of 060606.
Oh, cute. We're not making this up. He actually talked about a digital tattoo.
Luciferase.
Yeah.
The glow in the dark.
You know.
But, IHME, the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluations, is advising New York City and the White House Council of Economic Advisors, whose chairman is Larry Kudlow. He's Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And IHME was advising the Federal Dynamic Ventilator Reserve Program.
Yes. Remember the ventilator craze?
Let me read this to you, Tim. Yeah. This will take 2 minutes, but I think it's worth it. It's a little section in this chapter called The Great Ventilator Swap. Is mm-hmm. that right?
Yeah. Oh, go right ahead. Yeah.
Okay. This is a quote. State governors and the White House were virtue signaling to show that we're all in this together by shipping ventilators around the states and beyond. California assessed it might be short of ventilator supply early on and requested more. When 170 arrived from the national ventilator stockpile sent by President Trump, California Governor Gavin Newsom claimed some were broken and had to be repaired. In Illinois, Governor Pritzker, Jewish, claims he was competing with other states, the federal government, and other countries to purchase ventilators. In New York State, Governor Cuomo also complained that competition is driving up ventilator prices, since all 50 states plus the federal government are trying to acquire ventilators. The president quickly responded to Pritzker and sent 300 ventilators to Illinois, but has been dismissive of Cuomo and New York, refusing ventilators. That is when Oregon and Washington came to the rescue of New York, since Trump would not. Oregon Governor Kate Brown sent ventilators to New York, and Washington Governor Inslee returned over 400 ventilators to the national stockpile so they could go to New York. California, perhaps having repaired some of the broken ones, returned some to the national stockpile to help New York. California ventilators in the national stockpile were sent to Nevada, Maryland, Delaware, the District of Columbia, the Northern Marianas Islands, and Guam. Colorado ordered 500 ventilators, but they were seized by FEMA instead. Trump, artist of the deal, negotiated with FEMA and eked out 100 to Colorado. Cuomo had to finally admit New York had thousands of unused ventilators in storage. Governor Cuomo went on to send ventilators to Michigan and Maryland. Outcry arose when President Trump suggested sending ventilators to Europe. He had already sent ventilators to China with minimal outcry. It turns out Chinese businessmen sent ventilators to New York.
Is there money changing hands here?
There was prestige and virtue changing hands.
Of course, the ventilators actually did much more harm than good, because the problem would be solved by ventilators, the oxygen absorption, right? That's what I understand.
Right. Right?
Yes, they actually killed people, actually, because the intubation, if you will, it actually killed people. But they got paid more to intubate people, three times more, from the CARES Act. So there were some whistleblowers that said that the hospitals were killing people with these things just to get more money.
Senator Jensen from Minnesota is also an MD. He pointed out the three times the insurance payment if you put people on ventilators.
Yeah.
That was satanic. I think.
And he gave a COVID diagnosis, meaning
yes.
$30,000 and $39,000. So you come in, you know, with a broken ankle and they test you for COVID, you're a COVID patient. Hospital gets the money. And of course, this is the time hospitals are shutting down, so they've been denied revenue from regular procedures or elective procedures. And so, again, the demand for money is even stronger.
I call the ventilators the new guillotine.
Mm-hmm.
They were death machines, and intentionally so.
Yeah, the death rate was over 90% or something, right? Go on those things.
Yes, it was, and then of course the death was attributed to COVID.
Mm-hmm.
But Gates was funding, you know, research at Ohio University. Ohio State also got the One Health Initiative with Ethiopia, which is where Tedros was formerly the communist health minister. You know, here's Ohio State working with the One Health Initiative in Ethiopia. Leslie Wexner, the Jewish child-raping blackmail ringleader, you know, organized crime boss, is funding Ohio State's School of Medicine, where they conducted AstraZeneca vaccine trials in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
So you see these tie-ins with these satanic Jewish oligarch crime lords funding, you know, mainstream, apparently legitimate medical schools and vaccine trials. Whitney Webb's new book is a lot about that, how organized crime joined in with like legitimate intelligence agencies, and in this case, you know, medical industry infrastructure.
Yeah, Operation Underworld, and then the Jewish mafia involving itself, particularly after the founding of Israel,
in 1948.
And then some of these Mo Dalits and would launder their reputation by giving to foundations and these things. And to
Meyer Lansky
was never quite as successful as like Mo Dalits. People know Meyer Lansky as the gangster, Murder Incorporated. Most people don't know Mo Dalits' name.
Mm-hmm.
He did get an award from the, the ADL Tortures of Liberty Award.
That's right. For heaven's sake, it's just grotesque. Yeah. These, you know.
And there's a lot of you go to this foundation. I was listening to something. I was watching some thing on hurricane research, and I was listening to it, and it's, oh, the Rosenstiel Foundation. He's the guy, mobster, that was involved. I think he was involved in with Roy Cohn in New York, and
that's
compromising
right.
so many people. But he's giving these foundations, and they launder their money. They're not cheap. People, you say, they're cheap. No, they know how to spend their money to pursue their interests. Right. They spread
their
it widely.
Their philanthropy is like marketing. It's investing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly true. And so when you see Gates investing $12 million in Duke University in 2019 and $6 million more, they're conducting the COVID-19 Pandemic Response Network,
a
study of 200,000 people, with the goal of tracking their COVID spreading behavior. And, here we have $12 million just in 1 year. This whole chapter is examining what I call the Gates Grant Tracker, all the funding that Gates gave to different organizations and schools and, pharmaceutical companies and government and all kinds of things. It's off the charts. In, 2006, Warren Buffett donated $30 billion in stock from the Berkshire Hathaway Holding Company to the Gates Foundation. $30 billion. Mm-hmm. That was in preparation for the year of vaccine, the decade of vaccines that they had announced through CEPI, the Committee for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations.
Mm-hmm.
They're planning, and funding 10 years of vaccine promotion.
Well, you have lockstep the Rockefeller Brothers paper. These white papers predicting this stuff. I mentioned Event 201. And so what was that document predicting adverse vaccine reaction? Kim even predicted that, how that would be gamed.
That wasn't in lockstep.
It wasn't. There was another, what was the document? I forget the name of the document, but all things are, again, how they kind of war game and plan these things out, or various scenarios, contingency planning, whatever you want to call it. And it can be played out. Again, these things can be brought out, kind of unveiled, and become reality. And that's what appears. And then you have the movies like Contagion. I think that's where social distancing, I think, was first mentioned. And
yes.
Then these movies, they incorporate real media figures, like Dr. Sanjay Gupta is in Contagion.
Right.
So you're watching Contagion, and now you're confusing this even. Becomes even more confusing because you start to reality and fantasy become blurred, and it always is blurred with the media. And that's what I started noticing this in a lot of movies where you had real media figures or real politicians in movies. When in the past you would never have a real journalist in the movie playing his role, and it's a way of confusing, but again, a blurry reality so you can manipulate the public.
Well, they did that with Zelensky.
That's right.
Ukraine. But I mentioned Contagion a few times in this book. I actually made a kind of BitChute video examining that. It has quite a bit of satanic symbolism and Freemasonic numbers hidden in the background, and they're talking on the radio. Route 33 is blocked. And yeah, Contagion was a kind of milestone in what I call depictive programming, letting us know what's coming. But
the magic virus cure saves the day, right?
And there was
the magic shot, the jab saves the day, rather. Yeah,
it's always virus vaccine to the rescue.
Mm-hmm.
And in that story, there was the alternative treatment that was being suppressed, and that ended up
Jude
being,
Law played that creepy internet guy or something. Yeah, yeah.
It ended up being a scam. He was just raking in the money on the fake cure. He was Jewish. He was definitely a Semitic character. It was called forsythia, which is like a flowering shrub. Let me read the a conclusion to this chapter, Tim. Quote: "The contrast between their for-profit companies inflicting harm on the world's poor and sick, and their philanthropies supposedly trying to save them, is either schizophrenic or an interactive plan for power, profit, and control. Perhaps it is both." And then I call Bill Gates the world's most evil philanthropist.
Well, he's got a lot of competition there too in history.
Well, yes. I think he's still at some level a kind of front man, like we saw with the new group of world servers. Mm-hmm. He's not among the custodians of the plan. He's that next level down. He's a public spokesman, molds public opinion.
He appears to be set up for that position his entire life. The nerd versus the, you know, Steven Jobs, the cool guy, right? That was
right.
It's a marketing thing. So he's sort of like a, you know, Chef Boyardee, or he's put out there on a face, you know, Alfred E. Newman, right, if you will. You know?
Pretty much. IBM gave him the operating system. Mm-hmm. He didn't develop that. And it's intentionally poor and, you know, porous to cyber virus yes. infiltration.
But didn't he, like, when he was working at that school, he actually developed viruses. And so then what you do is you develop antivirus software. Well, that's funny. That's an interesting business model.
Right.
You can apply that in other fields, can't you?
Sure, certainly. Medical field.
Yeah. His mother, of course, his father, big on Planned Parenthood and all that. But his mother, I think, was good friends with the head of IBM. And all that is IBM. Again, you have to look at it from a corporate model. All these corporations are all interlocked. And they're not really independent agencies. There's a study that shows that basically it's a few dozen banks control, you know, most of not all the corporations through efforts like BlackRock or Vanguard, you know.
Yes.
So
yeah, mostly stock ownership and the threat of selling it and crashing the stock price.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, through corporate control, you can get around government. You know, there's national governments that start all the wars, supposedly, according to H.G. Wells. Through corporate governance, ESG, you become the real governing bodies, governance as opposed to government. And that's why you have a lot of the much of what we see, or we would call the New World Order, the Great Reset, or the woke stuff, political correctness is being instituted through ESG at the corporate level. Laws aren't being really passed. Even the censorship, although with Twitter and the Elon Musk, it exposed direct government involvement with FBI and CIA, these things in coordinating a censorship program. And right now there's hearings on it. But we do know that basically the outfits, private intelligence agencies like the ADL, Southern Poverty Law Center, will coordinate with alphabet soup agencies like the FBI quite often. But censorship programs can be conducted outside government. And then we can just say, well, it's the free market. What are you going to do? You're being deplatformed. What are you going to do?
Right. Right. The Israeli government is notorious for spinning off private startups, but then still controlling them, like out of Unit 8200 and yeah. Palantir. And
yeah, was that Jorge or something? Another one that's manipulating elections. They use their basically manipulation of social media using bots. And they're mm-hmm. you know, private companies and outfits will hire them. It's Project Jorge or something. Unit 8200 is very disturbing because basically you have all these Israeli intel officers, high tech. You're working for, basically electronic or spying people, and they'll spying on governments and corporations. Then they'll leave 8200 and go to work for Silicon Valley.
Right.
And, exactly. But do they ever leave? I mean, of course not. And this goes back to the suspicion of what's their primary loyalty if they do. And then right, I think our current head of cybersecurity is Neuberger. I think is her name. She's a Zionist. Her family is. What's your primary loyalties, right?
You know. No doubt. I know that Transition Integrity Project was gaming the stealing of the 2020 election. Another one of those tabletop scenarios, you know.
It's pretty much panned out, right? That's what happened.
Yes, and on the board of Transition Integrity Project was Michael Chertoff. You know, Zionist. He was the
Rapiscan guy.
The Homeland Security after 9/11. And
he's the one that got the dancing Israelis out of the country.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was head of the. He was the assistant. He would think he was the assistant U.S. attorney
of the criminal division of the Department of Justice.
Yeah.
He was supposed to investigate 9/11 and Ground Zero as a crime, but he turned it over to the military as an act of war. So oversaw the removal of the steel girders through Schnitzer steel. That's basically a crime, removing evidence from a crime scene.
Yeah, they did the same thing in Oklahoma City, the Alpha B. Murray building. They demolished the building, guarded the evidence.
They do that to a lot of schools that get shot up by a mass shooting.
Yeah.
You just destroy the school.
Let's get rid of the school. Get the evidence. And
yeah. Can't nothing, have any ballistics showing up.
Nothing to see here. Move along, as they say.
Well, Tim, we've come to the last chapter, which is its own category within the book. The final resolution of the Jewish issue, a Jungian view.
Hmm.
So throughout the book, I call it the Jewish problem or the Jewish question. The only thing is, a problem has a solution and a question has an answer. And none of those have worked in history. So in fact, in some sense, they've made the Jewish problem or question worse. So I propose that we now call it the Jewish issue. And it has a final resolution, because an issue is much more complex. It's multifaceted. And a resolution is something entirely different. And I think that's what we have to rely on at this point. You know, so I rely on a quote from Carl Jung, who said, "The greatest and most important problems in life are all, in a certain sense, insoluble. They can never be solved, only outgrown." You know, so I go through this last chapter as like considering how can we like outgrow the Jewish issue, or if it's insoluble, what's the resolution? And Jung said something like, let me see, he's got a further quote here. "This outgrowing, as I formerly called it, on further experience, was seen to consist in a new level of consciousness. Some higher or wider interest arose on the person's horizon, and through this widening of view, the insoluble problem lost its urgency. It was not solved logically in its own terms, but faded out when confronted with a new and stronger life tendency." So I'm not quite sure. You know, most attempts to solve the Jewish problem or answer the Jewish question have failed, entrenching Jews into their exceptionalist religion, exalted racial status, pathetic victimhood, and extreme in-group solidarity. So resolving the Jewish issue is so extraordinary and complex that it takes something kind of beyond our consciousness and beyond our current conception. If you can conceive of that.
Well, I think it also, much of the problem of it is also within ourselves.
Well, yes. Yeah. Yes, we get to that concept of integration, the Jungian concept that there's a shadow and an ego, and they're in a kind of conflict, but the resolution of that conflict is to integrate the shadow into the ego, to make the unconscious conscious. So I propose the idea that the Jews might be the shadow to the Aryans. I just, in a sense, label the entire white civilization today as Aryan,
mm-hmm.
in a kind of archetype model, and Jews being the archetype of the shadow and the Aryans being the archetype of the Western civilization, being the ego.
Yeah, you have a situation where they will exploit the weaknesses, concupiscence, our tendency towards sin, obviously pornography and these things, or even to usury, our desire to live beyond our means, to pay, get now, pay later. Now you could say, well, then if you don't like it, don't accept the deal, but it doesn't justify the offer to begin with. That would be a more Christian outlook on these things, as opposed to the Jewish outlook, which is, you know, buyer beware, which is very Jewish. And most people actually have internalized that. Same with usury, you know, same with circumcision. These are all attributes that we've kind of internalized ourselves in the broad society, and we suffer for it. The idea is, again, deny them their victimhood. How do you do that? Well, one thing is you have to have the sense that I think you phrase it this way. The number one issue or problem confronting us is the Jewish issue or question. The second problem is our willingness to ask the question, to deal with that issue. And you could actually flip those if you want, because if you flipped it, you could say, if people could ask the question, then the problem goes away, because it's sort of it's a mental hold. It's a bluff. There aren't enough of them to physically control people, so they have to mentally control you. And also you have to really be willing to realize the reality of the category to begin with. Though, when you say the Jews, and, you know, the comedian you know, said two things you don't ever say is the and Jews. Those are the two words you never combine. Well, why is that? You know, mm-hmm. And most people think when they do that, think you are a latter day, you know, Adolf Hitler for doing that. And that goes in the whole narrative of the Second World War and the demonization of Germany of during the war and Adolf Hitler and that caricature, you know.
Yes.
So there's so much to unravel there. I mean, to undo.
There is. I mean, yeah. There is a number of strategies that were employed to answer the Jewish question or solve the Jewish problem. And I have a list of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to read something that the National Socialist said in a military journal, a military journal in 1938. Let me see if I can find this here. So we are now going to have a total solution to the Jewish question. The program is clear. It reads total separation, total segregation. What does this mean? It does not only mean the total exclusion of the Jews from the German economic system. It means much more. No German can be expected to live under the same roof as Jews. The Jews must be chased out of our houses and our residential districts and made to live in rows or blocks of houses where they can keep to themselves and come into contact with Germans as little as possible. They must be clearly identified. And when we compel the rich Jews to provide for the poor of their race, which will certainly be necessary, they will all sink together into a pit of criminality.
Mm-hmm.
So this has been tried in other ways. The Pale of Settlement in Russia. There was plans to move Jews to Madagascar, Uganda, and of course Palestine. Right. And this is an attempt to resolve the Jewish issue. Just put them all among themselves and let them kind of implode under their own internal conflict. But that's never been possible. You know, the nation of Israel is, of course, today lavishly supported by the United States.
Yes.
And they have Zionist agents all over the world.
On and off the books, yeah.
Right? AIPAC being the obvious one, but... So, you know, I'm proposing that, you know, that's a good try, and the Germans tried it, and then they tried expelling them. That was another potential solution. So here's my list. Did you want to say something?
Well, that's the problem with the question of Israel is the idea was if you create a homeland, it would be a homeland. But it hasn't been a homeland. It's become just a pirate's cove for Jewish treachery. And at the same time, you have the diaspora still operating in, you know, throughout these countries, particularly the liberal West. And so they've gotten both, and it's further just complicated the matter.
Well, here's what Adolf Hitler said about that as far back as 1924 in Mein Kampf.
Mm-hmm.
He said, while the Zionists try to make the rest of the world believe that the new national consciousness of the Jews will be satisfied by the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine, Israel, the Jews thereby adopt another means to dupe the simple-minded Aryan. They have not the slightest intentions of building up a Jewish state in Palestine so as to live in it. What they are really aiming at is to establish a central organization for their international swindling and cheating. As a sovereign state, this cannot be controlled by any of the other states. Therefore, it can serve as a refuge for swindlers who have been found out, and at the same time, a high school for the training of other swindlers. He was absolutely correct in that. There's actually an essay by Andrew Joyce on the Occidental Observer about how Israel is a refuge for criminals that are, you know,
mm-hmm.
trying to be prosecuted in other nations and a training ground for swindlers around the world.
Yeah, and also for a network of spy training, like Unit 8200, and, you know, where they can infiltrate the high-tech companies of the West, particularly the United States, which handle all our communications, transfers, and you know, these things. And I was reading an article a few years ago about it was Ohio, the comptroller's Jewish, and he made sure that Ohio bought Israeli bonds as part of their
mm-hmm.
pension plans. Mm-hmm. Or the head of the Conservative Party in Great Britain making sure that a lot of the contracts for the National Health go to Israeli firms.
Right, and the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, he's Jewish, his daughter and son-in-law are providing curriculum materials for critical race theory in the schools, and so, you know, Garland is, like, prosecuting mothers who are protesting pornography in the school library.
Yeah, calling them terrorists.
Yeah.
Potential terrorist. And at the same time, the FBI is teaming up with the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is evidently connected to Antifa, and they're burning down cities, particularly, you know, like that training center in Atlanta, the police training center. He's going after pro-life, advocates for having the temerity of praying outside abortion clinics, you know.
Right. So, you know, Jewish nepotism is a very difficult factor to overcome when pursuing the final resolution.
Well, the problem is we live in liberal societies where we can't make that category. We're supposed to think we're civic nationalists. We're all individuals. We don't belong to groups. That group doesn't exist. We only belong to groups to the extent that we can be criticized, or if you're an oppressed group that the Jews identify. Blacks, transgender, homosexuals, right? These are, you know, now privileged groups that are used to go after, you know, the ethnic white majority, which, you know, Jews broadly identify as these are the vestiges of Christianity. You know, that's Europe. Christendom, there was a time the faith was Europe, the Europe was the faith, it was Christendom, then it became Christianity with the Reformation. But basically it's an antithesis towards Christianity, which is now transposed, or at least kind of transmogrified into, like, white. It's European symbols. It's the Occident. It's all that it is. And they hate it. And they're besieging the gates of Rome when they're doing this, you know.
Yes, and it seems, I think we can all agree that despite all these various efforts to solve the problem or answer the question, it's only gotten worse. It's hard to imagine it being any worse than it is today. I know not enough people seem to even realize this, but the Jewish domination of the U.S. and much of the world is almost total. And it was revealed in the COVID program, which was a major operation to further this control and transform the world and into the Great Reset into a transhumanist, what they call digital dictatorship.
Well, a good example of that, you illustrate it, is the pardon of Jonathan Pollard.
Jonathan Pollard.
Where, you know, organized Jewry, Sheldon Adelson, all these organizations have been lobbying for years to get him pardoned. For what? Oh, because he's Jewish? I mean, does he really warrant a pardon? But he betrayed us to our arch enemy, the Soviet Union, to benefit Israel. By the time, at the time he was going for that job, people in security said, don't give it to him. But I think it was B'nai B'rith lobbied for him to get the job. So he betrays the country, gets caught, and he goes to jail. And by the way, now he probably won't go to jail. It shows you how much Jewish power has developed since the 1980s or 80s or 90s when he was caught. But of course, Sheldon Adelson lobbies for it. They parents pay Trump to give the pardon. He's flown back in Sheldon Adelson's plane. He lands in Tel Aviv. He's given a hero's welcome. And obviously, to the Jews that paid for his pardon, lobbied for his pardon, his Jewish identity mattered more than his U.S. citizenship. So that's their priority. And he's treated like a hero in Israel. So, well, if he's a hero in Israel for portraying the United States, how can Israel be our ally? I remember I said that. I was at a cookout. People looked at me dumbfounded, like they couldn't answer me. Yeah, it's like, this is that illustrates it perfectly right there. They're all lobbying for it. And then not only does it show what Pollard is, it shows what people who support Pollard, their priority, and they're billionaires, and they control both parties. That's a serious problem. It highlights the problem. And then Pollard gives a speech in Israel urging all Jews to do what he did, betray the United States on behalf of Israel.
You know, that and his reception in Israel as a hero couldn't have been a greater insult to the United States.
Yeah.
And they were just wide open about it. Their total dominance and control of the U.S. is evident by that whole story with Jonathan Pollard.
I mean, other spies Aldrich Ames. What is he? I don't know. Scottish? Is there a Scottish Political Action Committee? Is there a Scottish power, you know, lobbying for his? I'm assuming he's Scott. I don't remember his name, what his ethnicity is. But remember Aldrich Ames, you know, are they going to lobby for his pardon? And is there a country he can fly to? Did he fly to Scotland to get it? I'm just, you know, because he wasn't spying on behalf. I'm just drawing the analogy. Other spies don't get the same, you know, treatment. Robert Hansen, right? Is there, like, Danish Americans lobbying for his pardon? So there's a difference.
The difference is extreme.
Yeah.
And the final resolution is I have to confess, in this chapter, I feel like I didn't really identify it. I have a on my list of essays to write. It would probably be a series of essays will be, you know, to examine some of the attempts to resolve the Jewish question, or in my case, what I want to say, resolve the Jewish issue, like the Pale of Settlement, mm-hmm. like the National Socialist Transfer Agreement. So things that have been tried in history, and how well did they work? Because we need to examine that and try to adapt them for our times. But obviously, none of them have worked. They may have made things worse. So,
well, they can't work in a liberal society or a society that has a it's non-confessional. In the past, traditional confessional states would identify the Jew as not being practicing Christian, therefore an alien group. They cannot be afforded the same rights and privileges. And people right. understood that. And, of course, with Jewish emancipation in the 19th century, in the wake of the Napoleonic Wars, you had liberal societies develop, and the idea of civic virtues and citizenship, we're all citizens. And quickly, organized Jewry was able to sort of inveigle itself and take over some of these liberal societies, particularly like Great Britain, with areas of finance, with the Rothschild banking. And the United States has always been a Jewish paradise. From the big change was the late 19th century when they came over from the Pale of the Settlement, and they immediately came in and they took control of media and finance, and not control, but that control increased throughout the years, and they eventually were able to supplant the WASP establishment, the people that controlled the country.
By the 70s.
And you can also see it as sort of a generational thing, because the Rockefellers are getting old, and they did this through the control of media and finance. And not to mention the two wars they were able to engineer to get the United States in on their behalf.
Not to mention.
Yeah.
I have a new essay I'm going to be submitting to Occidental Observer, the second in my series, Jewish Control of U.S. Presidents. And this one's Ronald Reagan. So that you could say 1980 was maybe the transition from WASP to Jew control.
Mm-hmm.
It had been building and shifting prior, but might make the case that Reaganomics was, he was installed by MCA and.
Yes, Lou Wasserman. Yeah.
Lou Wasserman. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Milton Friedman economics, these things. And this is even libertarianism was sort of a. This is an example of them controlling both ends here, whether socialism or libertarianism. It's Jewish. Yep.
That's right.
And I made a point. I was, conservative Jews will use conservatism to achieve Jewish interest, and liberal Jews use liberalism to achieve Jewish interest. Mm-hmm. I was arguing with a sibling about this, and I was talking about Chuckie Schumer. Senator Schumer is an advocate of abortion on demand in the United States, but he opposes abortion on demand in Israel. Now, if he were a liberal, he was making them clear that they're liberal. They act this way because they're a liberal. And I said, no, they use liberalism. I was saying, if Chuckie Schumer is a liberal, then he would support abortion on demand in Israel, the same as the United States. Same way, why do they support unrestricted immigration in the United States and not in Israel?
Right.
If it's a liberal principle, it'd be both. Obviously, they're serving an interest there, or in Europe for that matter. Yeah,
it's not a political ideology. It's a racial agenda.
Yeah, it's ethnic strategy. It's an ethnic group, and it's ethnic warfare. That's something. It's sort of the hidden grammar or subtext to American history is ethnic warfare.
Yes, that's that, and we're losing. And I guess I'll read the final paragraph of my mm-hmm. book, Tim, and we'll close out. I do want to mention, how to buy the book and
mm-hmm.
direct listeners to my Substack page and Occidental Observer. But, I do confess that I struggled to identify the final resolution of the Jewish issue. So let me just say this. May this be the final resolution of the Jewish issue. Whites reclaiming the will to power, the final conflict, and the reascendance of the white race. Good and order shall be restored on the wheel of time. What we do now, how we act, from what inner resolve and spirit in this endgame transition is our sacred calling. May we be sparks of light in the dark Kali Yuga, that can ignite the next golden age and reascent of humanity's true leaders. So here I'm referring to the Hindu mythology, mm-hmm. Kind of looking at that from a Jungian perspective of the archetypes of this great battle at the end times of history and the turning of the wheel from the dark age, which we are in now, where the natural order is inverted and the Semitic race is in power and the Aryan race is in submission. That's an inversion of the natural order, which is a characteristic of the dark age. And then there's this final conflict, and then the golden age is renewed and things are placed back into their proper order. So that's a very vague and kind of mythological final resolution, but that was the best I can come up with for now.
Yeah, it's something with the United States is difficult because there's no, I mean, given the ideas that going to the United States founding, with the Bill of Rights and freedom of exercise of religion, separation of church and state, it's hard to see a return to that given the current rules, because they exploit the current rules. Hmm. And so they're going to bring on a reaction, which is going to require drastic measures if they keep going the way they're going. I mean, they're pushing the war towards nuclear war with Russia, right? Hmm. They're threatening, their brinkmanship with Russia over lousy Ukraine, which is another Jewish operation,
Yes.
And it's just absolutely a money laundering Jewish ethnic cleansing operation, in my opinion, at this point. So many people have written up on it, but apparently they're all anti-Semitic, Hilaire Belloc or G.K. Chesterton, Adolf Hitler, Henry Ford. Mm-hmm. They're all the one big
Charles Lindbergh.
Charles Lindbergh, So. Yeah,
I think that that strategy of labeling someone an anti-Semite is fading. It's losing its sting. I do think there's a kind of pendulum swing as this Jewish depravity and power flexing becomes so flagrant and just so obvious. More and more people are awakening. It's not such a taboo topic to discuss anymore.
Well, they're turning us into Weimar Germany. And then you can't ignore it when that gets that bad.
It becomes so bad that it gets good again. There's that reaction. That's mm-hmm. that's the pendulum swing of history. That's always been the case. So that's our hope, I feel. And it's, you saw Jonathan Greenblatt referring to the Holocaust as whether it was real or a hoax. Regardless, did you see that statement from Greenblatt?
No. When did he say this?
Like last week.
Whether it was real or
yeah, you can't question it, whether it was real or imaginary or whatever.
Yeah, you can't
question it. I'll send it to you.
Interesting.
I'll send it to you on email. It was fascinating. He's like, they're kind of admitting themselves more and more because, the truth will out anyway. It's a kind of controlled opposition they call that limited hangout, right?
Yeah. But didn't Steven Spielberg do that in Schindler's List? When he had the shower turn out to be a shower?
Yes, exactly. I just watched that clip recently.
I remember I saw it at the theater thinking, it's going to be gas because that's the story. And of course, by the time that movie was made, the whole narrative of the shower's gas chamber had collapsed. So that's why he did that, I suppose.
Was that after the Ernst Zundel trial in Canada?
I think it was going on at the time. Ernst Zundel, was that the night? Schindler's List was 1993.
Oh, Zundel was 85 and then the retrial in 88.
Okay, so it was after that. But he had done the Shoah, was that he had done a foundation or something, and he invited everyone to give their story. And, of course, everyone can provide a story, of course. That's not really evidence, and everyone's going to give the story. But he sort of, in that movie, admits that that whole narrative, because then we're into shifting narratives, because we're still given the narrative of the Holocaust in that movie, of course.
Right.
And
that Shoah Foundation took, 50,000 eyewitness testimonies, and then he cherry-picked 50 of them.
Yeah.
And featured them.
A lot of them were apparently a lot of them were saying, nothing happened. I just worked and ate and war ended. And
right?
You know, it's like, well, we don't want to hear that.
That's what Paul Racinière said. He was a French communist that was in three different German prisons, including Auschwitz. He said, I have eyewitness testimony. I didn't see a single mass gassing.
No. But then after the war and this whole narrative starts to be constructed in the 30, 40 years after the war, it's like kind of if you follow it, then if you're going to tell us, you're going to be the one that saw Mengele, because you're going to tell these embellished stories, because you want to, you know, everyone saw Mengele, Mengele, you know, the angel of death. He was there, you know?
Yes.
So it's, again, it's a narrative, and you have to, and how these things are utilized, but that's important, because what we're talking about here, of course, that's the sort of the foundation of it all, because criticizing any exercise or abuse of Jewish power, acknowledging it exists, is a invitation to a second Holocaust or a pogrom or something in the eyes.
Yeah.
So you can't do that. And, you know,
that's one reason. It also threatens their reparations payments.
Yeah, there's that.
A good strategy for frightening Jews to move to Israel. It's a way to cover up and whitewash the atrocities that the Allies really committed.
Mm-hmm.
Attributing it to the...
Well, that was Eisenhower's primary objective in spinning that narrative and creating the films, the propaganda films that they had Belsen and with the shrunken heads and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that the Holocaust reverberates throughout history. Therefore, the payments have to go on forever. Mm-hmm. Literally, that's much what they say.
Well, trauma can be genetically transferred to the next generation.
Yes, I've heard of that. Yes, multi-generational Holocaust survivors. As a great-grandson of a Holocaust survivor.
At this point, Holocaust revision is just funny. There's so many funny memes about it.
Mm-hmm.
I just get the greatest laughs from some of these Telegram pages. I don't know, the memes that come up about the Holocaust are just a good dark humor. I think a lot of people at least suspect, it's some kind of war propaganda or atrocity story.
Yeah. Babies on bayonets, that sort of thing, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, World War I. So. Okay, so your book. Where do you want people to get it?
COVID Culprits, an Inquest Chronicle by Carl Hamers, can be purchased at barnesreview.org, Barnes, review.org. It is on Amazon if you insist, but better to get it from Barnes. They publish my other essays in their magazine, bi-monthly magazine, The Barnes Review. And you could go to my Substack page, Taboo Truth. I post pretty regularly there, entries and essays. And of course, I'm also publishing at theoccidentalobserver.net. Pretty regularly. I think I'm up to over 24 essays since 2020. That first one you were reading about in the spring of 2020, Bill Gates and patent lawyers. I don't know. I think that's all I need to say about where to buy the book. I really hope that can spread. I hope people can get a chance to read that and talk about it and really come to a clear understanding of the Jewish role in the COVID scamdemic, because it was transformative. I think it's a pivot point in history, and it's heading to a very dark dystopian future that's by design of the Jewish power elite. So we need to stop it, and knowledge is power. First, we need to know about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, great. Well, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Tim. It's been a pleasure.
I'll let you go get some rest, and I'll post this pretty soon, maybe after I do a little editing, and then I'll send you the link.
Thank you, Tim. Take care.
Good night, then.
A world become one. Salads and sun, only a fool would say that. A boy with a plan, a natural man, wearing a white Stetson hat. Unhand that Gandhi gun, there's no one to fire. Everybody on the street has murder in his eyes. You feel no pain, and you're younger than you realize. Only a fool would say that. Only a fool.
Un tonto le decía esto.